ahead and get started because we're 3 minutes past our start time, and hopefully he will be able to join us. The time is now 9:33, and I call this meeting on the Committee of Behavior Analysts to order. Ms. Folks, will you do a roll call, please?
Yes, thank you. Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
I think he just joined.
He's in the process. I'm so sorry about that. My link was not working, and I don't know what my issue was.
Dr. Davey?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can now, yes. Dr. Reitz?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Excellent. Thank you. I lost my agenda already. Off to a good start. All right.
My computer's already restarted twice. Zoom had an update. I'm just like, I should have, like, you know, I don't know. I'm going to have to start putting that on my morning to-do list as, like, check for updates for Zoom, because apparently every day they're doing something fancy.
All right. I apologize. I have someone grabbing the whining baby in the background. All right. That was not the agenda either. I had just pulled it up.
Madam Chair, you can just blame me. The baby was probably sleeping had we been on time.
Brandon. All right. Sorry about that. Yes, we will. We'll go ahead and blame Dr. Davey. Haven't even met her yet, and you're already causing problems.
I know. That's the way I like to roll.
All right. I will move to agenda item number 3, general remarks and comments. As per our usual remarks, I wanted to thank the board staff again for all of their hard work. I know that it's been kind of a challenging time, and, you know, where we thought we were starting to see some changes from how the summer went, it looks like we've done a very quick pivot to even more potential probably difficulties in getting down to the office, probably working remote, getting access to materials. It's been a challenge. They've also been working on e-licensing, and the full board meetings are still quite heavy in their agendas. And so thank you, board staff, for all that you do and for helping keep us all in line, because that has been probably not an easy chore for you guys to do. So thank you for that. We appreciate your hard work. I also am very excited to announce that going into 2021, we will have a fifth committee member. That committee member is joining us today as an observer. I am sure that you guys will agree that this will be a great addition to the committee, but we are welcoming Tisha Denton. Her first official committee meeting will be the January meeting. And Heidi, I don't know if you can, but if you could email out the committee again, the January dates, just so that we have them, and then she will have them for her calendar as well. That would be greatly appreciated. We'll do a more formal announcement in January for Tisha joining us, but I wanted to kind of preface it now, make you guys aware that we did finally get our fifth committee member after months. I think we've been sitting since March trying to get this process through. So thank you, Heidi, for your work on that. I know that you were very diligent in following up with the governor's office and making sure that we got this. So I'm going to open it up to committee members. If you guys have any comments, and then well, let me start with Tisha first. Tisha, do you want to just briefly introduce yourself? Nothing super fancy. We'll do a formal introduction tomorrow, or not tomorrow. I don't know. Maybe I'll do it tomorrow, next month. But if you just want to briefly introduce yourself, and you will be observing today.
Absolutely. Well, I am thrilled to be observing today to join. I am Tisha Denton. I am a board certified behavior analyst. I serve on the side as the executive clinical director of Hope Group. I am very excited to bring my past to to the table and to oversee making sure that we practice ethically in the state of Arizona.
Excellent. Welcome, Tisha. And for committee members, any comments that you guys would like to make?
Madam Chair, if I may.
Absolutely, Dr. Stemmes.
Ms. Den, welcome and congratulations. And you'll be a great addition to this committee. Appreciate the effort you're going to do for us.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'll just echo that. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Den. And we're happy to have another set of eyes on the process. I hope you've got, you know, if you don't already have reading glasses, I used to have 20/20 vision before I joined the committee and the board. I now have, monitors that are the size of walls and reading glasses to get through all the materials. So I hope you have some free time and enjoy, you know, really getting into the weeds that is governance of the practice of behavior analysts in the state of Arizona. So welcome.
Well, we can certainly test the independent variable of all of this reading because I don't yet have glasses. So we'll see how this process goes and if we can find a cause and effect relationship.
Glasses and gray hair and a goatee in 3 years and we'll see that that's actually what happens.
Yeah, I'm hoping to pass the goatee, but other than that, let's see how it goes.
Dr. Davey, she has not signed all of her paperwork yet. So please be careful as to how much information you share. We would not like to scare her away.
My whole family is positive with COVID right now, so I can't quite get to a notary. But we will we'll get there and I'll sign them regardless of what you say. I'll do it.
As you.
Dr. Rates, did you want to add something?
I would also just say welcome. We're so excited to have you. I have not, you know, gone the goatee route myself, so I'm confident that you'll make it through. The glasses, however, yes, that's a pretty good possibility.
Well, thank you so much for the welcome. I appreciate it very much.
Excellent. Thank you. Tisha, we're excited to have you, and we will do a more formal introduction next month when it's time to get started on all the work. All right. Let's now move to agenda item number 4, approval of minutes. We do have the October 30th, 2020 regular session minutes, October 30th, 2020 executive session minutes. I was not present for that meeting, and so I will need for the committee members to vote on that in my absence.
This is Dr. Davey. I'll move to accept the minutes.
Dr. Stenhoff, I'll second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries, and that is with 3 ayes and 1 recusal. All right, we are now going to go ahead and move to agenda item
number 6, Madam
Number Chair. 6, thank you. Agenda item number 6, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding allegations of possible unprofessional conduct concerning behavior analysts identified in investigative record for complaint 2101. Ms. Michelson, will you please provide the committee an overview?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will provide a brief overview to refresh everyone's memory. At the CBA's meeting on August 28th of 2020, the committee reviewed complaint number 21-01 against Brian Schaefer, a licensed behavior analyst. The complaint was filed by Mr. Schaefer's supervisor, HR, who is also a licensed behavior analyst. The complaint alleged that Mr. Schaefer roughhoused with a minor client, mock the client, and engage in other inappropriate behaviors during 2 therapy sessions at one of the agency's clinics where Mr. Schaefer was employed. The complaint indicated that based on the circumstances and video footage reviewed, the agency terminated his employment of July of 2020. The committee reviewed the complaint and elected to forward it to the board with the recommendation of multiple violations of unprofessional conduct. During the case review, the committee raised concerns over certain practices at the agency as it related to billing, supervision practices, adequacy of Mr. Schaefer's supervision, the initial intake work completed on the client, and the agency's responsiveness to the board's subpoena for medical records. At the committee's meeting on September 28th, the committee requested that staff add an agenda item to a future meeting to discuss making possible recommendations to the board about opening a complaint regarding licensed behavior analysts identified in the investigative record. This report is included with your file that was uploaded to the portal. If the committee determines that any of the licensed behavior analysts identified in the investigative record for Mr. Schaefer's report may have possibly committed an act of unprofessional conduct pursuant to 32-2091, the committee may recommend to the board that they open a complaint for further investigation against these individuals. The board would then review the committee's recommendation at an upcoming public meeting. At my request, Ms. Hillary Ramirez, the complainant and clinical director for the agency, is present today. She was Mr. Schaefer's direct supervisor. Also present is Samantha Schultz, who is the regional director for the agency, and I believe she signed off on some of Mr. Schaefer's clinical documentation. This concludes my summary. Please let me know if there are any questions.
Excellent, thank you. And as just a reminder to committee members, this is just a review to see if a complaint should be open. So we won't be we can ask some questions to just make sure we have clarification as to whether or not we want to move in that direction, but we won't be conducting an initial or an informal interview. So the nature of the questioning does need to be limited to just whether or not we feel that there is a reason to potentially open a complaint. We do have Ms. Schultz and Ms. Ramirez with us to answer any of those questions. Thank you guys both for being here. I do want to just let you guys know that we are aware of how nerve-wracking this process can be and that that as we try to navigate kind of the different components, please know that we are very interested in hearing your guys' perspective, that we will work to get to the bottom of kind of the concerns that the committee members have, but that I promise that this shouldn't be too scary, not as scary as it might feel going into this call, and then depending on the outcome of this call, going into the next call. I think, and I add in that the Committee on Behavior Analysis, I say we're relatively new. We're going on our third year. We started in December of 2017. So we just hit 3 years. And so this is an actual new territory for us as well. So bear with us as we navigate this. We do have legal representation present as well for the committee and the board, and he will help us navigate this as well. So what we will do here is I would like to take a moment to just have each of you introduce yourself, and then we'll open it up for committee members to ask any questions they may have. Ms. Ramirez, would you like to just introduce yourself just for the record?
Yes, I'm Hillary Ramirez, and I'm a BCBA clinical director for Blue Sprig, and I'd like to thank the board for all your time with all of this through this process. And it is a little nerve-wracking, but you guys all do a great job, and I really appreciate all efforts to ensure that all behavior analysts in the state of Arizona are practicing ethically. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ramirez. Ms. Schultz?
Yes, good morning, everybody. My name is Samantha Schultz. I am the regional director for Blue Sprig. I also thank you all for your support during this, and I appreciate that you acknowledge that it's a little nerve-wracking. I think that as behavior analysts, this is like the worst case scenario, right? We you know, put in a complaint against somebody that we felt was appropriate, and then it came back on us, and we were like, we're trying to do everything right here. So I appreciate the opportunity for us to address any of your guys' concerns. I have a statement prepared, but I'll let you guys ask the questions that you want to ask, and you know, we are open to be as transparent as possible, because our goal is to help all of the kids in all of our states that we're operating in and do it the best way that we possibly can and ensure that we're following all ethical guidelines. So we appreciate your support throughout all of this as well.
And Ms. Schultz, you are welcome to make that statement now if you would like, okay. Or you sure. Can wait for questions. It's totally up to you.
No, I will go ahead and give you my statement. I hope you all had a good Thanksgiving. It is a full moon week, right? So I think there's been chaos with everything. So the Zoom not working and the baby crying right when it comes on, I feel like that's appropriate. I joked that my kids are homeschooling right now at home, and I was like, have a really important meeting. Please set everything up independently. And they're like fighting already. And I was like, oh, this is going to be good. So I appreciate all of your patience this morning. And I appreciate the opportunity to discuss the practices at Blue Sprig. We strive to do our best and we actively seek feedback from others to improve our processes and to ensure that we're providing high quality of services to the families that we serve. Each employee is licensed and or certified per their state requirements in the state in which they practice. All employees go through a thorough training that has been created by our learning and development team in collaboration with our chief clinical officer. Our intake and onboarding process for admitting new families is designed to be as seamless as possible for the families that are seeking ABA services. The last thing that we would ever want to cause is additional stress. We have made modifications due to COVID, but we still provide virtual tours to our families and an opportunity for them to learn about Blue Sprig while getting their questions answered about ABA. Our goal is to have an assessment completed within 4 weeks of starting so that the families have access to care quickly. We have noticed a delay due to COVID, as we have strict policies related to illness and potential COVID exposures. The intake process that was discussed in the previous case was not our typical onboarding process due to credentialing. There was also some variables with that family as well that caused a delay in services getting started. This was communicated to the family and a list of other providers was also given to them when they first initially reached out to Blue Sprig. The family requested to wait with us though until we were in network. The board had expressed some concerns about the entire medical record not being sent over during the initial subpoena. Our compliance team pulled all records to submit, and it was an oversight that the date range was not accurate. There were two missing documents, and both were sent over immediately after the compliance team was notified that they were missing. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to address any concerns that you guys have, and will do my best to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. Committee members, do we have some questions? Dr. Davey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is Ms. Galvin on this call as well?
No, we have Mark Harris today.
I'm just nervous about questions. I mean, I guess just in terms of procedure, just asking questions, considering this is not a interview or anything. This is more of a discussion item. So I guess I'll phrase my questions as more of a discussion, colleague to colleague, with Ms. Schultz and Ms. Ramirez. And so I think one of the things that would be helpful for me to understand as someone who's been in similar positions to you, where there's BCBAs underneath you that may even have additional BCBAs underneath them, that then have direct line staff underneath them, perhaps you could speak to us about how you all personally, like, you know, whether it's the organization's policy or not, how, you know, maybe starting with Hillary and then going to Samantha, how you provide supervision to those master's level clinicians. Because one of the things that I'm having a problem with is that the individual was a BCBA. He is the holder of the license. And by in doing so, he is, you know, the buck stops with him in many respects in terms of BACB guidelines. But there is language in there about when we supervise. And you both are listed as supervisors. My guess is in the hierarchy of your organization, your org charts, the way you sign off on documents. And so I'd like to hear just about how you guys operate that. And if through this, you know, through this kind of discussion you've had with the board and watching kind of the adjudication of the complaint and now, you know, what we're going through today, has that been modified? Are there things that are in the works? I would just like to have a discussion about that, I guess, versus, you know, questioning.
Yeah, I can go first. I did meet with Mr. Schaefer weekly and observed him during other direction sessions with other clients, assessments. I walked him through our assessment process, did it with him. You know, I tried to be as present and supportive as possible amid all of the variables with COVID and trying to ensure that we took precautions. And, you know, we did speak weekly via email and over the phone, telehealth, just trying to make sure that he did get the adequate support he needed, even though I was not physically there due to COVID. So really trying to ensure. I also checked in with Ms. Schultz weekly, talking to her, making sure that I was supporting him adequately. And if there were things that I needed to improve on, You know, we have, as Ms. Schultz said, we always take feedback as how we can improve. I consistently asked him as well, how can I support you better? What can I do more? Because I wanted to make sure that I was being supportive to him and providing adequate supervision and guidance during this very interesting time that we've all been experiencing through COVID.
And then I can jump in. So my support, I typically don't work directly with the clinical supervisors that are overseeing cases. The clinical directors, they oversee their work. I did in this case sit in on meetings typically once a month with Mr. Schaefer and with Hillary, just to see how things were going with him, especially once his performance improvement plan was put into place. I do meet with all of my clinical directors weekly. I should say probably formally we meet weekly, but we probably talk 5 times a day, just to discuss all of the other issues that, you know, may come up or any questions that they may have.
And when you guys have these meetings, these things are documented. You guys have them, obviously, like in the employee correction or feedback. I'm assuming HR has that documented on the clinical side when things are just going well and those check-ins, Ms. Ramirez, is that information recorded in the EHR or is that information recorded in the HRIS? Where is that kind of info stored and reviewed?
Yes, so I have taken my own documentation. We also have made efforts to ensure that we do have proper documentation for those meetings. That way they can be, you know, coordinated and collected by HR, so we have record of it. So I did have emails that I had between Mr. Schaefer and myself that I saved and had documentation and provided that with his file as well.
I think I'll stop there and let some other committee members engage in the conversation, but I think I'll probably have some follow-up later. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yeah, so question for either one of you. What do you see your, I guess, directorship roles as far as oversight to your clinical supervisors? And to what extent do you believe that you need to meet, or under what circumstances would you need to meet with one of your clinical supervisors?
Sure, I can go first. So being as, you know, being the clinical director and being there on site pre-COVID and also virtually during COVID, you know, it's my responsibility to make sure that I'm checking in with the other clinical supervisors, that if they have questions, they have concerns, I'm there to be supportive to them. As much support as they need or collaboration or checking in, you know, ensuring that the recommendations they are making are appropriate and sound for the clients, that direction being done to their RBTs for their clients are being done appropriately and supportively, and really ensuring that they are displaying our values as an organization. And, you know, whatever help they need, I'm always there. I'm happy to help. If I don't know the answer, I seek guidance from Ms. Schultz or from other you know, behavior analysts within our organizations and try to ensure that they do get the appropriate support. And because that is my ethical responsibility, not only as a BCBA, but also as their direct supervisor.
I think in terms of my support that is provided, pre-COVID, I did not meet with the clinical directors as often. I don't think that there was as many issues that were arising. Things were seeming to go as smoothly as possible. But with COVID, there's definitely a need for meetings more often. And I try to make myself available as much as possible to them to navigate. I feel like most of the support that I'm providing is more on the operation side, right? Somebody has a COVID exposure. What do we do now? And that's been the bulk of, I feel like, most of our conversations at this point is just navigating those different operational things that are popping up left and right.
Okay. And then, or I'll say it this way, is there an expectation that the clinical supervisors would contact and Ms. Ramirez, mainly this, I guess this is for you based on the conversation we've had so far. Is there an expectation that they should or would reach out to you if there were issues that they needed to discuss with you?
Yes. And I also make, you know, a lot of the time, you know, I also try very hard to make sure that I am checking in and that they are comfortable with coming to me and talking to me and really focusing on that pairing of the relationship at the start, making sure that they feel comfortable and supported. So even if they are saying everything's fine, I still try to make sure that I'm checking in, that I'm observing sessions, that I'm, you know, making sure that they do have that support and they feel comfortable to do so. And there were multiple times that he did reach out to me and I did check in with him and we discussed it and we went over it. And, you know, so I'm always available and I make that very clear to everybody that it doesn't matter what time or what you need, just call me or text me or whatever. And I'll be there so that we can discuss it.
Okay. And under what, how is that invitation for them to contact you conveyed, verbally, and verbally meaning textually, vocal, so on?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So whenever we have a new clinician that starts, clinical supervisor, I meet with them and talk with them and get to know them and pair, obviously. And then I let them know, you know, my responsibility here is to be a support to you and to help you and guide you in whatever you need. I know how crazy it can be when you first get your certification and passing and trying to figure out and navigate everything. And we're all meant to be a team and to work together. And so I'm here for you for that. I also, in whatever introduction email I send, like before they start, I let them know the same thing. So I reiterate every time, either verbally or textually, that I'm here for them. And so far, the feedback that I've gotten from all of the other supervisors that I've supported has been that they always know they can call me if they need anything. Mm-hmm. And they've been comfortable with that.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. I do also send out emails to any new clinical supervisor to introduce myself, since I might not see them right away, especially with, you know, limited travel due to COVID. So I introduce myself and let them know that if they ever have any concerns or if they ever need any additional support, that I'm here for them as well.
Okay. And is there a culture of ongoing invitation for them to contact? You both have mentioned initially during, you know, the onboarding, mm-hmm. so to speak, but is there an ongoing invitation as well? And in what manner is that invitation provided?
Absolutely. So like just recently, I did a follow-up with all of our clinical supervisors and sent out emails to them to just say, how are you doing? You know, I'm so sorry that I'm not going to be able to see you for a little bit. You know, COVID has presented challenges with traveling, so I'm here if you need anything. And I don't know that Hillary gives them an opportunity to have to reach out. She is probably one of the best people at keeping in contact with others. She's established relationships with people from other states, and she calls them, like during her commute, she's calling everybody to check in. So she's making sure that she's in contact with all of her staff every single week. So they know that she's there for them. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Ramirez, Ms. Schultz. Madam Chair, I have no other questions at this time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have a follow-up to one of Dr. Stenhoff's questions, if you don't mind.
Absolutely, Dr. David.
Does Blue Sprig have an ethics hotline, a place where staff, family members can either anonymously or with their name attached make an inquiry or file a complaint?
We have a compliance hotline, and so we have a phone number and an email. So you can call the compliance hotline or you can send an email if you prefer to go that route.
Okay. And then Ms. Ramirez, how many BCBAs do you supervise?
Currently I'm supervising two. We have one in our Chandler location and then also one that's supporting Chandler and the Scottsdale area.
So two full-time BCBAs, and kind of, yes, in your description, does it give a range of how many BCBAs you would supervise?
We're just kind of starting up right now, it's just been two. That's been the number that I've supported so far. We are continuing to grow and trying to build, but we also have it set up to where it is in a capacity that is appropriate and where we're able to provide adequate support, that it wouldn't be stretching or, you know, over extending ourselves like we would with any clients that we do oversee as well with the BCBA caseload. So always ensuring that it's in an appropriate amount and also meeting all the ethical requirements.
So maybe I'll spin that discussion item over to Ms. Schultz, who has, mm-hmm, other.
Sure.
About the I think that's what we said. And Michelle Kiorvo, the regional director, what is the typical caseload for individuals within Blue Sprig in someone like Ms. Ramirez's position?
So right now, I would say fullest center has 5 BCBAs in that building. So 5 BCBAs to 1 clinical director.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was just my follow-up to Dr. Stenhouse's questions. I appreciate it. Madam Chair, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you. Any additional questions from committee members? I have a few. And I'm going to start with more specifics related to kind of the documentation as we were unraveling. The first one was in the medical record and everything that we received, there wasn't or didn't appear to be anything specific to the ability to record or consent for recording. And that's something I know that Ms. Ramirez was at the meetings, and so you probably heard the discussion around that, that the current handbook talks about the use of materials for training purposes or the use of materials for marketing purposes, but there's nothing in there as signed consents for clients to be recorded during sessions. I wanted to ask in follow-up to that, one, is that a process that you guys had in place that maybe was overlooked, or two, perhaps knowing that is being brought to your attention, what changes have been made or will you work to, address those potential, issue?
Yep. So it was my understanding that was in our parent handbook, but our compliance team has created a statement that they will be implementing and having families sign off on that since that was brought up, that was a concern that it wasn't there. So yes, we did acknowledge that it wasn't as clean as it should have been and maybe as clear to families. And so we have made that modification and are adding that to our parent handbook with a specific signature line to that specific statement of being recorded during the session.
Excellent. Thank you. And then I wanted to address, Ms. Ramirez, you mentioned that you guys are starting to work on a process for meeting documentation, specifically with HR and employment matters, even for more supervision like meetings between like clinical director or regional director. I just wanted to comment to that I appreciate you sharing that with us. There isn't really any statutory requirements for documenting those types of meetings. However, the reason why we bring it up and we suggest it is because when these things happen, if there is no documentation, it's like it didn't happen. And we get this he said, she said situation. And so I appreciate you guys working together to come up with a means of, potentially documenting, if even informally, those sorts of meetings so that, you're able to protect yourself, but also demonstrate, hey, these are the standards that we have for kind of our quality measures. So thank you for that. Looking at kind of the timeline of how everything happened with this particular case and case file, it appears that, or there was a report that there was a BCBA involved in the initial onboarding up till about March. Can you speak to that BCBA's role and what their current role is? I would be cautious and remind you, I don't think you guys have legal representation here. I'd be cautious to remind you that there's only so much information, obviously, you can share about like employment matters, but I'm just trying to gauge who that individual was, how it came about that they were involved, but then not involved, and who actually wrote, because we had reports that there was a treatment plan that was written, and that a new treatment plan was needed. However, we don't have any proof of the original treatment plan. So I'm just trying to gauge what happened kind of between December and March.
Sure, I can speak to that. Sorry, my son is turning off all the lights around me, so I'm in the dark now. Sorry, guys. So fun.
Yeah, you got to just realize that that is the world we live in, each of us.
You know, and despite that we're so deep into it, I still feel a need to, like, give that disclaimer at, like, every single time. My son's currently dancing on the table in front of me. You can't make it up, guys. Okay, so yes, I would like to talk to speak to that. So the first clinician, what she did was she did one intake assessment, one intake meeting with that family. And then she did the PDDBI with them, and I'm speaking purely from memory. So let me see if I can pull up actual information, because I don't want to give you guys anything inaccurate. So we had a clinician who started the assessment process. She started prior to actually being in network with TRICARE. And I will be very honest, she just did it. Like, she was like, oh, I have this authorization, I'm going to do it. We'll submit non-billable, we'll get this family started. She is no longer with the company. She left at the end of February. And when she had given her notice, she talked to the family about leaving, and the family wanted to wait for the new clinician to come on board so they could meet the new clinician, which is the Mr. Schaefer. And at that point, she did not have a treatment plan. She had a very rough draft with some information that she got in the intake process. When Mr. Schaefer came on board, they did an observation together, which he had talked about at a Chick-fil-A, and he felt like it was not a good representation of this client. He did not feel like he had an adequate picture of this child's needs. And so he came to me and asked if it would be possible for him to redo the assessment. He didn't feel like he had any information needed to make a good treatment plan. We did not have an authorization for that, but it was what was in the best interest of that child. And so I had given him approval to do what he needed to do to have a good picture. And the family was on board with that. They appreciated the fact that he was considerate of what their child's needs were. Because the first observation that he didn't see any challenges. He did not see a need for services, but they were at a location where the child had no demands placed. And so with the parents' concerns of what they were struggling with their child, they didn't get to see that. So he stepped in and he asked to do an assessment. So there was not a treatment plan that was created. I know it sounded like there was when he was discussing. There really wasn't. It was a couple pieces of information that she had plugged in, and she had passed it off to him with the idea that he would complete the treatment plan. He would identify those goals, and he did not feel like that Chick-fil-A observation was good enough. He and Hillary had completed a portion of the assessment together because he identified that he had never worked with a child that was verbal. And so he didn't know how to test for that. And so Hillary stepped in so that they could do that component together and identify goals that were in line with his deficits and what the family wanted to work on.
Thank you. That clarifies a lot of that time period. As far as assessment then goes, there was documentation of further observation, but there wasn't documentation of an actual assessment. Do you recall what assessment either tool was used, and if one wasn't used, what generally your process is for what is an assessment? Like, what does that include?
So I'm not sure if Hillary, if you know if there was something that was actually like an assessment tool that was utilized, or what that specifically looks like. I'll let you answer that question.
Yeah, so I know we did, Mr. Schaefer did the PDBI. He also did the Vineland. When I started to come in towards the end of him finishing that assessment, that's when I came in to support. And the plan had already been written and completed and was, you know, towards the end of it. I did do a couple more, like two more observations, or a meeting with the parent, with Mr. Schaefer, and then an observation of the client with the family as well, in which Mr. Schaefer and I would discuss it and review it and see what could be done further from that. And I can, I can pull up the treatment plan and look to see the other assessment tool that was utilized for him. But typically, depending on the client, it's either VBMAP or the ABLES, or you know, we have the LAPD, whatever is appropriate based on the client's age and current, you know, skill deficits and areas of concern.
If you wouldn't mind looking that up, because I want to make sure, I don't know if it's a discrepancy in documentation that was provided to us, or if maybe there was a disconnect, but I think one of the things that I noted and spoke to is there didn't appear to be anything but the PDDBI and parent interview and the two observations cited in the treatment plan. And so that's not to say that additional things were not done, but generally when we look to the treatment plan, we see kind of what the present levels and the findings were dependent on the tools that were used, and then how was the goals developed. Because one of the concerns that were noted was that one, it didn't appear to have any type of skill acquisition assessment used. There appeared to be a referral and a inconsistent parent interview around problem behavior, yet we had no skill acquisition assessment, but skill acquisition targets and no behavior assessment to address the reason for referral. And so I'm trying to figure out what assessment was used and what that role was. But while you're looking that up, I do have another question for Ms. Schultz. Mm-hmm. Can you describe your role in what what Blue Sprig or any supervisor expects of you when it comes to signing off? So one of the concerns that kind of red flagged during the meetings was that it appears that you guys have a QA process for those treatment plans to have somebody sign off on them. Can you talk about kind of your role, or I believe at the time there wasn't really a clinical director. So who's responsible for reviewing that documentation, and what is the role of actually, like, what is the purpose of having you sign that documentation?
Sure. So typically we have just a second set of eyes on any treatment plan that gets submitted, and that it doesn't have to be like a regional director, typically the clinical director or a clinical director from a different center may review that report for somebody. And it's to ensure that, you know, everything, there's, you know, no typos or issues within the report. And just to have that extra set of eyes for good measure, make sure there's no discrepancies within that. We did, when his report was created, we had rolled out changes due to COVID. We like no longer could do an in-person skills assessment. And so the idea was that the skills assessments would be done at the start of services when we were able to have a clinician in person with a family. But typically I review the reports, make sure that the goals are appropriate. I look for any kind of discrepancies that I would see within the report.
And I think, again, kind of what stood out to me on that particular situation was that from the treatment plan and as an outsider reviewing the treatment plan, there definitely were discrepancies. And so one of the challenges, and this is, and you guys said it at the beginning of the call, and I think it's important to reiterate and discuss, is one of the challenges is the moment we have a process like that, there's a little bit of a shift of clinical responsibility. When we look at specific complaints, and you guys absolutely did the right thing in how quickly you guys notified the regulatory bodies, how quickly you guys moved with the complaints and the concerns, all of those things were absolutely correct. Generally speaking, a licensed behavior analyst is able to practice independently. So whether or not you're mm-hmm. supervising them is a little bit, it's important for QA measures. It's important for, you know, some of the argument of I was new and I wasn't getting supported and those sorts of things. However, at the end of the day, the clinical responsibility lies in the individual that is independently licensed. When we have a process where we have a second person overseeing a treatment plan process, it kind of shifts a little bit of that clinical responsibility to mm-hmm. also that second person. So you know, for your role, Ms. Schultz, in reviewing that treatment plan, it kind of shifts that a little bit to where the person who's responsible isn't just the person who conducted the assessment, but also the person who says, I don't see any discrepancies here and we're good to go. Now, having said that, that's a risk that we take in leadership positions, right? What you don't get into a leadership position and expect that you can get away with delegating everything and then pleading the fifth later on, right? Like part of the risk of leadership is just that. But I wanted to kind of understand your guys' role and maybe even bring it to your attention of why that was a little bit alarming for us, is because in the treatment planning documentation, there were, from our perspective, discrepancies in the treatment plan between referral, what, again, potential assessments were not used. Mm-hmm. And even if a skill assessment couldn't be done because of COVID, I would highly recommend that be documented somewhere.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there was a big, from a clinical recommendation standpoint, there was a big disconnect between all of the pieces to show what really the child needed. And then when it took from treatment plan down to the actual work being done, none of the targets being worked on had anything to do with the treatment plan either. So it was it's very difficult for us to even see what was even happening, what treatment the child needed or was getting. And I don't know that anybody would be able to answer this is exactly what that child needed from a medical necessity standpoint. So I appreciate you you clarifying kind of what your role is there. And again, I do recognize that that's a risk that we take in leadership as part of what we do. Ms. Ramirez, were you able to find...
Yeah, so I did do that. And like Ms. Schultz says, that as with the COVID restrictions, it was that the skills assessment would be done. So the Vineland, once services started, so the Vineland and the PDVI were the two assessments that were used in that process. And we've since looked at, you know, exactly like what you said and reviewed of how we can improve and make things better and ensure that when we do have a second reviewer, you know, we double check everything and we're good, so.
And I would add to that, again, just make sure even with the COVID stuff that you're documenting that in the treatment plan, because that would have made a world of a difference to see like this couldn't be done because of X restriction or what have you, to allow for us to kind of navigate what that child's needs were and what their right to effective treatment would include. I do have another question regarding the referral process and the oversight as either supervisors or an organization from a QA perspective regarding the functional behavior assessment. So you've got substantial information coming from parents, not just in the initial referral, but also in each of the parent trainings where they're talking about still seeing these behaviors. You've got behavior data that's showing an increase in problem behavior. You've got a treatment plan that says, hey, we need to do an FBA, yet we're still sitting 6 months post start of treatment with no FBA. What is kind of your process for ensuring that if a recommendation or a referral comes in for a behavior assessment, that you're kind of seeing that process through, even if it happens where, you know, we get to a point where we're like, no, a behavior assessment isn't needed. But again, that comes down to a documentation issue where at what point do we then document, hey, we've exhausted all of our efforts here. And we've determined the behavior assessment isn't needed, or we've done multiple observations and we've determined that it isn't. What is kind of your guys' process around that? Because that was one of the concerns that came up, was this constant glaring problem behavior issue, but almost a non-action to the problem behavior or the parents' concerns to begin with.
Yeah, so one thing that we have since taken away from that initial meeting is we have retrained all of our staff. We conduct the ISCA. So we've retrained all of our BCBAs in running the ISCA to ensure that they feel confident. If they don't, they have additional support to make sure that they're comfortable running that assessment. And then what I've told all of my directors that are reviewing treatment plans is if it states in there that an FBA is going to be conducted at the onset of services, saying that we need the date. Like, put a date in there. Let's start holding them more accountable to it, because yes, it is the BCBA's responsibility to ensure that they're following that treatment plan that they wrote. But from an organization, we want to ensure too that this doesn't ever happen again, right? Like, we don't ever want this. I don't. And if it's happening in this center, it's probably happened elsewhere. And so we're really trying to ensure that across the board, we have policies in place to make sure that bears were supported on our end in terms of documentation. We can say, like, we trained on this, we checked them off on that, and now we're asking that this get scheduled on this date and we're notified that it's completed, or we sit in and provide support if that's needed as well.
Thank you. And I would reiterate with that's a good move, because again, for you, Ms. Schultz, your name is actually on that report.
Yeah.
It is again, one of those like, ooh, we really, if your name's going to be on there, you really, again, yeah, assume a bit of that clinical responsibility that requires then that follow-up. Speaking of the follow-up, one of the other issues that was noted was related to the consent to treat. It appeared that there was maybe an administrative error in getting a written consent for the actual treatment plan itself, in that the treatment plan was approved and ready to go in April, but there wasn't any consent until mid-May, or I don't have it in front of me, but there was a period of time in which there was no consent. As far as your guys's process or your process, either personally, for the consent to treat, is that something that is being done by the BCBAs that the BCBAs have responsibility for, or is that an administrative process?
So I do want to jump back. Just, we did have the family sign, and that was signed. Mr. Schaefer had collected the family signature. I believe it was, the original one was dated April 24th. However, he had them sign the copy that my name was not signed on. So I had them, once I was like, I'm not signing this again. I'm going to re-review it. I'll re-sign it. And now they need to sign with my signature on there as well. So that's why there was that discrepancy in dates, because he had them sign the copy that did not have my electronic signature on it. And I believe both of those were sent over, because when that first came up, I frantically looked through all 600 pages that you guys have of this file, and I found it. So I was like, no, we did this right. I promise we did. Typically what we do with COVID, and I hate to say like pre-COVID and post-COVID, you know, this is how we do it. But with COVID, we do review the treatment plans with the families, and then we will have them sign it electronically. Typically, we do that through like Teams, where we can grant them access to our computer or to the record, so that they're able to sign and provide that. So that is typically how we do it. Typically, the clinical supervisor is responsible for reviewing that treatment plan with the family, and then they will collect that signature and then pass that off to the operations person to then send out that treatment plan. And in this situation, yes, it was an oversight. The operations manager saw the family signature, sent off the treatment plan, but it didn't have my signature on there.
Okay. Yeah. And I did see, the other one come through, but in the scanned version that we had, it only had the signature and not the full document, which is fine. I was looking more for procedurally, is that something the clinicians are doing, or is that something, yes, that's administrative? Because our ethics call for that to be coming from the clinicians. And so when a clinician says, well, I don't really know the process because it's a company process, that's where we get those red flags of, well, no, our ethics needs to be this. So so I appreciate that. That provides clarification there. I have another question, and I apologize for bogarting all of this, but I have another question related to your process and policies around change in treatment plan, whether it's that we're changing modalities, or we're making substantial changes to the goals, what the process is around how you do that mid authorization period, because I think that's one of the there isn't really a hard and fast, because each contract requires different things and what have you. But one of the things that came up was, again, that kind of disconnect between assessment, treatment plan, and actual treatment that was happening. None of them matched. And so we were trying to figure out, essentially, when we send off a prior auth request, we're saying, here's the treatment plan that we want to run and the things we want to work on. And then all of a sudden, none of the clinical documentation matches anything that's in the treatment plan. So what is kind of your guys's, your personal, but also because you guys are leaders, what is your process for ensuring that the things that are in the treatment plan are being updated, that it's a living document? What does that look like for you guys?
So we do, you know, go through with the BCBAs and when we're talking about it, knowing that, you know, when we do start services, if there are changes that are needing to be made, that to ensure that things are appropriate for the client and their needs and their families, then that's done. So we also gain parent approval and making sure if the contract requires that we submit an addendum to the treatment plan, then that would be done so and submitted to the insurance plan. So then it would have approval so that it could be implemented. So of course, just making sure that we are, you know, not just doing whatever, that we are doing what's appropriate, necessary for the client and the family, and that we do have consent from the payer and per their contract requirements.
Perfect. And if they don't require an addendum, what does that process look like again to make sure that if I were to come in and say, hey, what treatment are you working on, that those things align?
Yeah. So when there's been, you know, if there's a change in something else going in, then I will notify the parents. I will also document it in the session note. If I do conduct a direction session and I see, you know what, we need to work on compliance and 1 and 2 step instructions, I will be discussing it with the families, and I do notate it in the documentation so that the parents, you know, I have that consent and that it is notated. That way it's there and it's not, well, it didn't happen if it's not documented. So making sure that it is documented, the parents are aware, and that we have that approval for them. And then I also have done where I've met with them during caregiver sessions and family guidance. And again, reiterating, these are the goals that we're going to be adding in to ensure that we have their consent and it's documented.
And then just to touch on clinical supervisors. So unfortunately, we did put these on hold because of COVID at that point. When all of this was going on, I think was when we were kind of in the thick of COVID. But we do have feedback forms that we do for all of our clinical supervisors, and they are.
Oh, I think we lost your sound. She doesn't look muted, but it does look like we lost her sound.
Yeah.
No, am I there?
There you are.
Am I here? Can you hear me? Am I back? Okay. Sorry. I have no idea where I cut off. I kept talking and then I saw like different, like, well, and I was like, okay, I don't think I have. Anyways, we have quarterly, we have feedback forms that we complete for BCBAs. And one of them is, we use Central Reach for our data collection platform. So we have a learning tree feedback form where we will take the treatment plan and we will take the learning tree and we will make sure that everything that is in the learning tree is documented in the treatment plan, or that we have documentation to ensure that we're able to work on that program. We also do like direction session feedback forms, family guidance feedback forms, and then report feedback forms as well. And we rotate those quarterly for our clinical supervisors.
Okay. Alrighty. And can you speak to any training that is provided funder specific? So one of the things that came up is this particular funder has a very strict no academics requirement, yet the entire treatment plan was around academics, or not the treatment plan, the actual work being done was around academics. What training do you guys provide to the BCBAs related to their funding, and or what do you test on their competency? Because I guess as an organization, again, it's up to the BCBA to know their contract requirements. But oftentimes when you work in an organization, the BCBAs never see those contracts. They just kind of assume that the organization's taking care of it. So what efforts do you guys have in place to make sure the BCBA knows what those funding requirements are?
I think this is an area that we need to continue to review and ensure that we have better training around what is appropriate to work on. I know that, you know, for me specifically, when I'm talking to the BCBAs, I talk about the academic piece. That's pretty true for most of our payers, that they don't want us to work on academics. They leave that to the school. So that's something that I generally talk to them about. I don't know that we have a formal training that they go through. We utilize LearnUpon for trainings, and we have, I hundreds of trainings on there at this point that we've developed, and we have all of our staff review. We do specifically have a training related to TRICARE and documentation requirements for TRICARE. But I think that in terms of payer specific trainings, that's something that we definitely, a takeaway that we have and an action item to improve on.
Thank you. I have one last question, and I think it's an important question. I think it's a very pertinent question to the current situation. You guys have had some change in higher level leadership over the course of this time as well. Can you speak to kind of some either new processes or new clinical oversight that's happening due to some of those changes, and perhaps share a little bit of kind of as an organization what changes have taken place as far as your clinical leadership?
Absolutely, I can speak to that. We are in the process of rolling out what I think is a really awesome clinical support team network. Dr. Michael Cameron did come on board as our chief clinical officer. And if any of you have had the opportunity to meet or work with him, he is amazing and has been one of the most supportive clinicians that I've worked with. So he has rolled out acquisition of Florida Autism Center, we have a lot of structural changes that are coming. And so with that, we have a team that he is developing that is strictly for clinical, that will not have their hands in operations and clinical, which I'm sure if any of you, I think most of you that are on this call have had the opportunity to be a BCBA, you know that as you move up, your role moves away from the clinical side and you move more towards the operational side. So Dr. Cameron is carving out a team that is strictly clinical. So we will have a clinical market director for all of our areas that will focus on all of these issues that we've just discussed. So, you know, ensuring that treatment plans are exactly the way that they should be based on the payer, the goals are appropriate, the skills assessments are completed within the timeline that they should be completed in, that the FBAs are being conducted. They'll also do just clinical auditing on a regular basis, and that is their only job. And so we've started rolling that out on the East Coast already. So that has, that came into play. I think they rolled that out about a month ago, and they're working their way west. Is that what you meant? Did I answer your question? Okay.
Absolutely. I think in a time like this, it's important to just note and highlight that there's some ongoing positive movement in clinicality that I think should be considered as we discuss it. So thank you for explaining that to us. I appreciate that. I have no further questions. So I don't know in my millions of questions, if any of the board, any other committee members came up with additional questions. Dr. Davey, do you have?
I had two that you, miraculously, you did not cover, but I know Dr. Waits hasn't had a chance to speak yet, so I'll defer to her. Are you good? I guess to kind of piggyback off the discussion around, you know, new and improved systems and kind of this, kind of firewall between operations and clinical, you know, having been on both sides and in the middle, like I appreciate the sentiment with that, but I think in a lot of ways there's some rose colored glasses around, well, clinical is going to be allowed to do all the things that they need to do and operations just has to stay out of it. And I think that that's, I don't doubt that you guys have, the fortitude to make that happen. But in this particular case, there were questions around how billing was going out and how billing was going to be constructed around an individual who was either a BCBA or whether he was acting as a tech based on different roles or different credentials the individual held at different times. And there's also the issue of multiple assessments, particularly when you're running through a BCBA. And I've seen this as a reviewer for health plans for, you know, more years than I care to mention, where a BCBA starts with a child, new BCBA comes in, whether it's with the same agency or another agency, and wants to provide an additional assessment. and the payers push back saying we've already paid for that and, you know, we're not going to pay for another one. Maybe some of the better payers will, you know, capitulate and allow for that to happen. But outside of what the payer says, you know, the clinical teams need to be able to do the things that they need to do. And if a reassessment is appropriate, or if, you know, that the initial assessment, as you've spoken about today, was not thorough and needed to be further assessment needed to occur, how do you, both of you in your positions, I mean, I think it kind of goes down, how do you see handling that moving forward when your ethical, like balancing your ethics, if you will, to provide effective treatment don't align with the payer or the operational practices of your organization?
Everything that we do, it goes back to the child. So if that child needs another assessment and the payer is not going to pay for it, we're going to produce a better treatment plan by completing that assessment. And if the family is comfortable with doing that assessment and they authorize for us to do that, it doesn't matter if we're getting paid for that or not. We need to make sure that our treatment plan is the best that it can be. And if that means doing that additional assessment, then that's what we do. And that's what we did in this case, where the clinician, we did not get paid for all the additional time that he put into it, but he felt like he needed to do more observations of the client, and we allowed for that to happen.
Mm. I think that that's something that, you know, small organizations have the same issue that large organizations have. It's a limited amount of resources, and those resources are beholden to producing to keep the organization going. It does not matter if you're a single practitioner or if you're an organization that has 1,000 BCBAs, and those pressures are real. And mm-hmm. the experience, you know, this experience, I do hope that you will take forward to your clinical team that is being carved out to speak about these things, because your ethical obligations do not get supplanted by operational needs or operational mm-hmm. quotas. And that is something that, you know, has to be a culture that is from the top down. It can't be coming from the clinicians and being pushed up. And so that's not really, you know, it's not an indictment of Blue Spring by any means. It's more of a discussion of our field that we yeah. make sure that we're
absolutely. Paying that.
The one other question I had was back to Ms. Ramirez. You know, in terms of supervising the BCBAs, and I know you said, you know, but we'll just talk about prior to COVID, you get a treatment plan, you know, either of you sign off on that treatment plan. When you go and conduct observations, whether they're remotely or in person, you know, I understand, like, you are obligated as a supervisor to take notes. You are obligated as a supervisor to have a feedback system. Are you, do you take the treatment plan? Obviously, you have access to the goals through Central Reach. Are you monitoring those for actually occurring during that time? Or are you strictly looking at opportunities to respond, error correction procedures? I mean, there's so much that goes on in an observation. My question is in an observation, of the individual that kind of brought us to the situation we're in today, you know, did you have the treatment plan in front of you, or was that treatment plan reviewed as part, you know, as part of kind of your pre-work to observing the individual? And if so, maybe you can talk about that procedure and what that procedure looks like today.
Yes, absolutely. I did observe Mr. Schaefer with another client prior to this client starting. I did reference the treatment plan to ensure, because this was another case that was acquired by Mr. Schaefer. So when I was calling in and doing the telehealth sessions to observe the direction session with the RBT and the client, I made sure that the targets or the treatment goals that were in the plan were ones being ran. And we also discussed afterwards, you know, if they were appropriate for the client, what was going to be done moving forward. There was reassessment. So definitely referencing and making sure. I did see that Mr. Schaefer was doing that, working on the targets that were indicated in the treatment plan. We discussed feedback afterwards and had gone through. I had not yet done that for the client in question with this case, but from all times before, he was following the treatment plan and working on the targets appropriately. And if he had questions, I was there to assist him and to help. And then also to help with his professionalism in terms of providing direction to the RBT and ensuring that it was supportive and adequate and provided the best environment for the RBT and client for successful sessions to occur.
Thank you. And then my final question is just a very blunt question. In the policies and procedure document, we have the handbook from Blue Sprig. Have you guys updated your restraint procedures, your restraint documentation in any way based on what occurred here in Arizona?
Yes, 100%. Dr. Cameron actually carved out a new policies and policy related to restraint and seclusion.
And does that, in absence of you sharing that with the committee, I mean, I think the things that still stick out in my mind in watching that video, but what the individual referred to as roughhousing, you know, picking a kid up off the floor, having his feet off the floor, being on top of an individual, whether in play or not, using a desk to pen someone into a particular area. Are those things addressed in this new policy as a no-no?
Absolutely. And those are things that we do not tolerate. We obviously were here as a result of that. So yes, the policy does reference what is appropriate. We also have a list of all clients that would have any type of restraint in their treatment plan so that we can have additional supports for those clinicians that are working with clients that may need some kind of safety care hold.
And so to that point, I'll go back and reference the desk situation. So you have a U-shaped table where a child is essentially in the teacher's position with the outside of the radius table kind of facing out into the open space. Like, I do not have a problem with that sort of environmental control when working with a child who may have a lack of attention, excess energy, whatever you may want to put the term to it. However, that has to be documented as a procedure within the individual's treatment plan. And so, as you kind of explained it, is that that exists now? Is there a committee within kind of your newly formed clinical expertise group that'll be looking at that, kind of a similar to like a human rights committee that would be able to then approve those kinds of things moving forward? Like, what kind of peer feedback?
Yep.
Providers, that's still just, is that coming from someone like Ms. Ramirez, who would say, yeah, that's appropriate, we've talked about it, you've gone through the training modules, we've checked the boxes, and we can move forward, which I would be fine with that as the answer. But I'm interested in it, how this has helped transform that policy and procedure, not only in writing, but then in actuality at the centers.
Absolutely. So we have a team that was developed. It's Grand Rounds, and that team is comprised of various clinicians. So we have, you know, both PhD level BCBAs. We have a pediatric neurologist, I believe, on site, an SLP. So we have an MFT. And so any of our clients that may need some kind of restraint or seclusion, we represent that case to Grand Rounds and discuss everything that we're doing to ensure that we have exhausted all possible options prior to moving into any type of restraint and seclusion.
Okay. And that is all documented in the medical record as well as in the committee's agenda and minute notes?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time with the follow-up questions. Thank you.
Absolutely. I have one more question that Dr. sprung my memory with as well. With regard to the supervision and overseeing, I agree with kind of Dr. Davies' perspective of making sure that, you know, we're reviewing the treatment plan before we go in and provide that feedback. Do you guys have a mechanism that, and I'll tell you, this is something that is that came up regarding the billing for program modification as well as the billing for parent training. Do you guys have a mechanism for doing fidelity checks on supervisors? So it's not just I'm observing and making sure you're implementing the treatment plan, but also if I come into a parent training to provide a supervisor feedback, that there's some sort of fidelity or procedure that is completed to provide that feedback and say, hey, here's you know, the information that should be happening, or here's what should be happening with parent training, and here are the pieces that you've missed or what have you. Are you doing any level of fidelity checks with the supervisors?
Yes, we have those. We have our feedback forms that we review with them, that we will take into those sessions and then review with them.
And how, and that, and those are the ones that you said happen quarterly?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And how do you determine, because I think this is, again, just one of those, you know, usually we see quarterly, we see 10% of cases, we see, you know, because you can't, you really can't be over all of them. However, you've got an outlier case that you know, may have gone rogue to those policies. What steps do you have in place to potentially catch those, especially as far as, sometimes what we see is that if an individual knows they're going to be supervised, then that case is usually up to par. Or so what do you do to kind of make sure that you're mitigating those potential biases in your process of auditing?
I think this is something that we're still building out and trying to make sure that, just like you said, you know, even Mr. Schaefer had referenced, like, oh, when you're here, I change my behavior and I say mm-hmm. things that I think you want to hear. And so that's something that we are in the process of building out, you know, how do we, and it is more challenging right now because we can't all be in person, right? So it's hard to just drop into a session now that we're remote and we need invites. But that is something that we are looking at and trying to navigate so that we can kind of just on the fly join in and do those observations.
And I've done check-ins, even with this family in particular, as Mr. Schaefer, I did check in with the family and make sure. And I think now with telehealth, trying to, you know, observe a family guidance session happening or observe a direction session happening where I could call in and make sure and just kind of check and then check with the notes afterwards and doing those fidelity checks and ensuring that, you know, what is happening or what I observe is then being documented accordingly. And if not, then, okay, we need to address this and we need to fix it, ensure that we are documenting things that are occurring in the session. And that, you know, it is in lines with our ethical obligations and pair requirements and our organizational policies and procedures as well.
Okay. One other question I have to that then is, as far as the variations in bill codes, do you guys have different in your EHR system? I'm not sure. You guys were using Central Reach, correct?
Was mm-hmm. that?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. In Central Reach, do you have differential session notes per bill type? Okay.
Yes.
And is
yes.
that something that was in place? Because that was something that I noted, that parent training was the session notes that were being documented were still that of direct care. And so there was a lot of kind of NAs and a lot of kind of blanket statements that were being put in there. Is that something you put into place now? Is it something that perhaps the clinician was unaware that they should be using a different template for a different bill type? And what do you do to kind of mitigate that, to make sure that you are getting that proper documentation? Because there was multiple program modification codes and parent training codes that were billed that the session documentation was very much documentation that would be requested of for direct care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe we actually rolled that out, I want to say mid-June or maybe July, where it auto-populates a different, based on the code that you bill, it will auto-populate the appropriate note so that it is tied directly to the service that you provided.
Perfect. Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? All right. Hearing none, what will happen now is we'll go into kind of just a little bit of deliberation. So there will be no more questions, and we'll just talk as a committee as to, based on the information you've shared with us today, what steps we're going to take next. So thank you guys very much. Please feel free to stay on and listen. Committee members, any thoughts on who would like to start us off? Dr. Davey, you look like you're very interested in starting this discussion.
Do I? I mean, I, the discussion I have is this is, 10 years ago, I don't think we'd have this discussion. And I think that this is part of the growth of our field. I think that we have, you know, multiple layers of supervisors, and executive clinical directors, and regional clinical directors, the clinical directors, the frontline BCBAs, and, you know, I don't want to age Dawn, but when we were in school, that kind of stuff just didn't happen. And so I appreciate the candor at which both Ms. Schultz and Ms. Ramirez have come forward and provided us the detail and spoke so eloquently about both the positive aspects of this, the difficult aspects of this, and potential shortcomings. I think, to get right to the point, I don't see a statute violation per Arizona statutes. I also, I think the closest it comes is when we talk about something that's adopted by the board, and that would be the BDCB guidelines. But even there, in looking at the discussion around supervision and being a supervisor, and that is not just supervising soon-to-be BCBAs, that is supervising active BCBAs. I just don't think that there's enough there to move forward with that. I do think that this process has most likely been eye-opening to not only Ms. Ramirez, but Mrs. Schultz, as well as Blue Sprig, and I hope that others that are listening that operate inside of any size of an agency are taking note to this discussion. I do think this, is something that this committee can work with the board with regard to ongoing CEUs. I know we've been talking about jurisprudence exams and different things like that to be able to help people understand the statutes and the rules. But, supervision within an organization may be something we need to think about moving forward and engaging some of the experts in the field to talk about that multi-tier and the responsibilities at each of those levels. So with that, I think that really closes my statements. I do think that, this has been, I appreciate the conversation by Blue Springs clinical team on this call and the discussion of the board. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. I would echo that. I'm not sure that this rises to a level of statutory concern based on the responses that we've heard today, because I think that, and Ms. Ramirez has been on some of the calls, I think that there are a couple of pieces to it. One is this idea of, what we really look to see is that other client, that there's mechanisms in place to ensure that all of the clients and the public is protected. And so sometimes there's little differences. Sometimes it's really just about process improvement and getting the right people in the right places to move forward with making these changes. I'm particularly appreciative of the fact that despite how difficult some of the commentary has been, Ms. Ramirez has continued to communicate actively with the board. She has continued to show up at the meetings, even though she knows that she may also be questioned we aren't intending to rip her apart, but it may feel like that in that moment. So I'm appreciative that she hasn't backed down from that, and that we've heard today that she has also taken those concerns back to her company and said, look, guys, this needs to change. And so that's, that is very, very, I think, comforting for me and some of the concerns. Now, some of the larger concerns that I had were clear discrepancies between what was being described to us versus what was really happening. So for example, we were told that there was a previous treatment plan. It's nowhere in the record. We're trying to figure out what's happening. Those sorts of things have all been clarified, and I feel comfortable with that. I do think that this is, that borderline slippery slope. I agree with Dr. Davey that the statute does include an adopted version of the BACB ethics code. And as such, unlike with the BACB, where that professional conduct code has kind of a gray area, it's actually statutory. It can be enforced from a rules and statute perspective here in Arizona. And so it's not perceived the same. And so we're at that very borderline slippery slope, specifically with Ms. Schultz, not to call you out, but specifically in the fact that again, by signing in approval of a document, you do assume a level of clinical responsibility for that document. And so I don't think that it's raised to a level there of, you know, of public concern, but I think that it could, should actions not be taken based on the feedback provided in this meeting. And so I really do appreciate you both being very responsive to the board and being here today to allow for us to get this clarification. But I agree with Dr. Davey. I don't know that that the information today that we've been provided would lend us to, or me to, believe that we've got a statute violation at this time.
And, you know, I would just want to say one other thing. I think that as time marches on, you know, in 2021, if Ms. Schultz and Ms. Ramirez, you know, I would always welcome you back to come talk to us about the things that you've done over the past 6 months and present them to us. Not, you know, it would be referenced the same way. It would actually just be a discussion item, where you could come back and show this, because I think, you know, this is an open meeting. There are, you know, several BCBAs on this call listening for various reasons. And I think that it's important that individuals like yourself that are touching these contingencies every single day share those experiences. And so I would just encourage you, if you're comfortable and Blue Spring is comfortable with that, that perhaps you consider that in the future and contact board staff if you'd like to kind of give us an update on how that process is going. I think we all learn from that. This every time I'm engaged in a discussion at this committee level or at the board level, I learn something new, and I learn, you know, how to better myself as a clinician, myself as a leader. And I think that many people on this committee and on the board feel the same way. And so we learn from you two that are out there day in and day out, interacting with clients, interacting with your agency and other professionals. So I would just encourage that if that's something that you feel would be productive. So thank you both.
Dr. Stenhoff.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Dr. Davey, I concur with your statements. To Ms. Schultz and Ms. Ramirez, I appreciate, as Dr. Davey said, as the candor in which you presented, and also the efforts that you took to, I'm going to call it, do your homework to come and prepared for these discussions. The other is, which is very commendable, is the fact that a difficult situation arose in your agency, but you educated, you pushed forth with a new policy, modified practices, and overall improved practices for your clientele, which you both stated during your comments today. So I wanted to point that out, commend you both on those efforts that you guys have done. So,
Dr. Reitz?
Yeah, I would echo my committee members. I don't think anybody ever wants to be the example. And so that said, it's helpful for everyone and it moves all of us forward. So we do appreciate, as Dr. Stenhoff said, that you did your homework, you came prepared, and you shared what you've done and what you're doing differently. And we appreciate that. And I would agree with, again, my committee members and say that I don't see anything here that would rise to a level.
Dr. Davey, did you have additional comments?
We don't really need a motion, so I think we can move on.
Yeah, I don't think that, because we're not taking any action, Mr. Harris, we don't need a motion, correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. If you decide not to move forward with this, you can just conclude this matter and move on to the other agenda items.
Excellent. Thank you. I just want to add one more thing to Dr. Davey's point. And I think that in having Dr. Cameron and his team, and Blue Sprig has several clinical leaders that that probably are very much looking at this as a huge learning opportunity, because I do have the opportunity to work with several of those leaders, in other capacities. And so I know that they're probably very quickly trying to work through process improvement and some other mechanisms to protect this, you know, the company and you guys from having to go through this again. But to Dr. Davies' point, I agree that this is a really good opportunity to consider potentially even reaching out to professional associations or having conversations at a level of educating other behavior analysts through continuing education events. I think that there's a couple of things that are important. One, the actual actions that you guys are taking, but two, this notion of this kind of underlying fear of reporting to the board, because I do see that I teach an ethics class. I do see a fear that if I report to the board, I may also get in trouble, this is a fear, and Ms. Schultz, you mentioned it. And so hopefully, mm-hmm. This experience and this process, has been a learning experience that wasn't as scary as it seemed. And that maybe that's an opportunity to educate colleagues on the importance of still, following our ethical obligations to report these things, and really the benefit of having, you know, kind of this conversation with a group of people who you know, want to have this dialect and want to see you guys succeed and want to see, you know, you're working with a very vulnerable population that needs services. And we have a lot of kids here in Arizona that need services. And so, mm-hmm. You know, if we're able to educate other professionals on this process and how we continue to strive to provide the best that we can for the public and in interest of the public and public protection, I think that would be something that I would hope the professional associations at CEU presentations and CEU levels would be interested in hearing from you guys on mm-hmm. of what your experience is and kind of what your outcome or what your what the outcomes were, because I think it's important. And, you know, as an ethics instructor, one of the things that I try to drive home, whether or not they take it, I don't know, but I try to drive home that ethics aren't black and white and that it's a continuous improvement. And to Dr. Davies' point, the ethics code, when those of us who were certified 10 plus years ago, that ethics code isn't even the same ethics code. We've had, this is now what, our third, fourth version of ethics. The task list isn't the same. There's all of these ever-changing positions of our field that I think that showing how you can take an instance like this, stand up to it, accept the peer feedback, accept what, you know, be a part of the process and then implement those changes, I think would be a really good message to share with your colleagues. And so I would echo Dr. Davies' recommendation to continue to educate others on what you guys are putting into place. And I hope that with some of the new changes that you guys are seeing with Blue Sprig and the new team members you guys have coming on, there's a lot of technology being that's probably accessible mm-hmm. and other things. So hopefully you guys feel comfortable moving forward with how all of this played out.
Absolutely. Thank you guys all so much. It was incredibly terrifying to get started, but I think, you know, Zoom issues, babies crying, kids dancing on the tables definitely helped lighten the mood. So I definitely feel like this could be a great CEU opportunity to discuss with others, because there is a fear around reporting. And, you know, Hillary and I, like I said, we probably talk 5 times a day. Every single conversation is, I would do this 100 times again. If that means that, you know, we did something wrong, we need to know, we need to improve. But if it means that we protected one child, it was worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate everything that the board has said. This has been very terrifying for me to kind of go through. But, you know, I think that we are constantly learning every day. We are evolving as a field and as a practice. And I've really appreciated being a part of this whole, you know, system, even though it was a little terrifying. And like, you know, Michelle said, I would do it again every day. It doesn't matter if I were to get my hand slapped, because it was the right thing to do to protect our client and to protect future clients and to ensure that we are practicing ethically and in line with the statutes and regulations and compliance codes of not only the BACB, but for, you know, the Arizona board. And I'm really proud to be a BCBA. I'm really proud to be a licensed behavior analyst, and I appreciate the feedback and, you know, your guys's words of, you know, reinforcement and everything. So thank you for that. This has, you know, been a great opportunity, and definitely would love to see how we can, you know, further and help more people and ensure that, you know, if you are concerned, you feel comfortable in reporting. So, and that it isn't a scary thing, but an opportunity for growth and learning. So thank you.
Thank you, guys. And you guys are welcome to stick around. These meetings are public meetings. So please feel free to join us at any time and listen in and learn from them. They are great opportunities. I tell my students to do the same. And many of us do require our students to attend at least one board meeting. So if it's something that you feel your staff would benefit from, they're open meetings, they're public. They're posted on the website. They're now recorded as well, so people can listen to past meetings. It's a great learning opportunity. So please don't wait until we call you here to come join us anytime. And we again appreciate you guys for being here and how professionally you've handled the situation.
Thank you guys all. Have a great day.
Yep. You have a great day.
Five, 10-minute break.
Yeah, let's go ahead. Do you want to do till 11:15? That puts us at about 7 minutes. Excellent. So we will resume at 11:15.
Thank you.
All right. We have everybody back, so let's go ahead and get started. I have a small disclaimer. It looks like my husband's being called out to work, so... because unlike the rest of us that get to sit on Zoom, he actually has to sometimes go to work. So I will have the baby in the room with me, but she should sleep or be fine if he does leave. All right. Getting started again. We are going to move to agenda item number 5, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation to the board pertaining to the approval of behavior analyst applicants. It looks like we've got... applicant number 4, Madison Bindick, on the phone. She's been waiting patiently, so let's go ahead. She's joining us today. Let's go ahead and review hers. Dr. Stenhoff, if you are ready, it looks like you are the committee member. Can you please provide us an overview?
Sure. Ms. Bindick received her BCBA certificate in August of this year. She graduated in December of 2018 from Arizona State University with a Master of Education Curriculum and Instruction. She received 1,684 hours of supervision from Elise LaFarrell and Brianna Connors, both are LBAs in Arizona. I did not note, well, I noted one concern, but I don't know if it's anything worthwhile to be concerned about, but on the application, it was noted that a passport was going to be provided for documentation of citizenship, but a driver's license was instead, but I'm not sure if that's worth concern. So, and that's it.
Ms. Folks, is that something that you can work to change if it's needed?
Unless Mr. Harris has a different opinion, that's not something I ever worry about. As long as there's an ID there that meets requirements, I don't worry what's written on the SIT form.
And Mr. Harris agrees.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, this is Dr. Rates. I just want to note that we do work at the same agency, but I feel like I can move forward with this application.
Perfect. Thank you. So hearing no concerns, does the committee members have any questions for Ms. Bindick? Excellent. Ms. Bindick, do you have any questions for us?
No, this is my first board meeting and it's been incredibly informative. So it's actually been quite the learning experience. So thank you for letting me sit in.
Absolutely. And like we told the others, they are public meetings. So you are welcome anytime. So, and we do appreciate you being here for the application review. It's extremely helpful. Because if we do end up with questions, usually we have to go back and forth and track down the applicant and schedule it for a new meeting. But you being here today has been extremely helpful. So thank you for being here.
No problem. Thank you, guys.
All right. So, Dr. Senhoff, you would like to move this application forward, correct?
Correct.
Excellent. Thank you. And then do we have anybody else on the phone that's an applicant? If we do, please unmute yourself. All right, hearing none, let's go ahead and proceed with applicant number one, Brandon Greenberg. I will note for the committee that the application that was uploaded was not the correct application. I've worked with Mrs. Folks and we have had a new application updated. I have reviewed it. And so my overview will not be of the one that was posted prior to this meeting, but the one that is available to us now. Mr. Greenberg did take his exam in November of 2019. He completed his master's in applied behavior analysis from Cal State Northridge. He did complete 1,500 hours of supervision in California, so there is not a licensing requirement for those supervisors. In review of the application, I do not see any concerns now that we have the correct one. And it should be available for you guys if you guys want to take a look. Otherwise, I am comfortable recommending this to move forward to the full board. Any comments from committee members? Excellent. We'll move on. If you guys are still looking and something comes up, just let me know. Number two, Ms. Gold. Dr. Davey, you are the lead committee member for Shantae Gold. Can you please provide us an overview?
Thank you. Ms. Gold. Yes, so Ms. Gold comes forward for application to become a licensed Arizona behavior analyst. She completed her application in full through my review. I noted that she graduated with a master's in education with an emphasis in applied behavior analysis at Arizona State University. She provided information with regard to her supervised experience towards licensure at the psychiatric centers of San Diego. Those on this committee understand that California does not have licensure. Therefore, we are provided with the supervisor's information signed up on 1,500 hours. They are in good standing with the BACB, and therefore I would move to have this forwarded to the full board.
Excellent, thank you. Any committee members with any questions or comments? Hearing none, we will move to number three, Jennifer Vasquez. Dr. Rates, you are the lead committee member. Can you please provide us an overview?
Yes, thank you. Jennifer received a BCBA in 2015. She completed a master's in science and ABA at Cal State Northridge also in 2015. She received 15 hours of supervision between October of 13 and October of 15. That supervision did take place in California, so I will be redundant in saying it is not required licensure. There was one question that did require additional information be provided, and reviewing that information, sounds like there were several variables related to COVID, organizational structure, personal. I think the applicant satisfied for me questions around that, so I would recommend that move forward.
Do the committee members have any questions or comments? Hearing none, we will move that one forward as well. The next one is number five, Skyra Mayo, and I am the lead committee member on that applicant.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'll just again, for the record, indicate that we are at the same organization, but feel that I can move forward in review of the application.
Perfect. Thank you. Ms. Mayo completed her exam in July of 2020. She did her master's degree in 2014 in special education, and in 2019 completed coursework from the University of West Florida in behavior analysis. She did her 1,500 hours through licensed behavior analyst here in Arizona. And I see no issues with her application and would recommend it to move forward to the full board. Any questions or comments from committee members? Excellent. Hearing none, we will move to applicant number six, Stacy DeMarinville or DeMarinville. Dr. Rates, you are the lead on this application. Will you please provide us an overview?
Stacy received her BCBA in October of 2020. She did a master's in education from ASU in 2015. She received just over 1,500 hours of supervision between 2018 and 2020, and that did occur by a licensed behavior analyst here in the state. Did not note any issues with the application and would recommend that it move forward.
Madam Chair, I had one question about this application, and I'm not sure how we'll address it, but so if we go to page 10 of the PDF for this application, it goes to the final verification form from the BACB, and the start dates on the far right top 12 of 2018 through April 2020. And so you've got this period of time where the individual is being supervised by the individuals listed. So you have Mr. Robles, you have Ms. Miha, and then Ms. Gutierrez. When I was looking at the individual's license status, their licenses appear to be in order for Mr. Robles, who had an active Arizona license starting in 2015, approved to supervise by the BACB in 15. Ms. Miha, active license in Arizona 17. Approved for supervision in 17. Ms. Gutierrez's license goes effective in Arizona 11/6 of 2019, and per the BACB documentation, still to this date does not have the modules completed for supervision. So my question really is to her status, when she was providing supervision, what number of hours she provided supervision, and if that would reduce her experience hours below the 1500 mark. So I'll pause there and see what others have to say.
I am taking a double look as well.
It's really interesting. The BACB does not require kind of the time frame. They just list them out, right? Obviously, she does not have the supervision modules completed per the printout we have from the BACB. So that would be public. And then just whether or not the time frame that she's providing supervision is in line with her license. So I think, you know, two separate but related questions that I would have.
And I think what's interesting about, and we've seen it before, is that this is the same documentation that the BACB accepted. I'm not sure if they accepted it because the responsible party, which is Mr. Robles, if perhaps he was who they considered met the requirements. But it's interesting. I think it makes no difference. I think you bring up a really good point, Dr. Davey, because from our rules, I think we would need that clarification, because our rules, if the BACB interprets it that way, I'm not sure our rules would allow us the flexibility to interpret it that way.
I don't believe so, Madam Chair. I think as much as we want to be able to accept these forms, and 9 to 10, the verification form is acceptable. This is one of those instances where we need additional information to be able to just move forward with that form. So I'd like to see board staff reach out and get those points clarified before moving us forward to the panel.
So are we looking at potentially, well, I think this is, and this kind of piggybacks into some discussion on another agenda item. I think that procedurally, my request would be that we go with an actual request for information instead of having Kathy kind of chase it down and then her make a decision and kind of go back and forth. I think this is a circumstance where we need additional supervision documentation specific to the number of hours that Ms. Gutierrez supervised. And I think it's important in all of that, because Ms. Gutierrez may still be supervising, and this might be a good opportunity to make sure that she's aware of this expectation as well.
I agree. I think a request for information is appropriate. This is not a phone call and tracking down a couple of signatures and a wrong checkbox. This is a letter requesting that information. I agree.
Madam Chair, committee members, this is Kathy. Do you want to have copies of the supervision logs?
You know, I think, the supervision logs would be great. It's almost as if I'd almost rather they fill out our form on supervised experience for Mrs. Gutierrez to complete that or something to that effect.
Would just an explanation suffice? Could she write an explanation, or could the supervisor provide us?
I think Mrs. Gutierrez should fill out one of our forms, quite honestly, because then she will sign off on when that supervision period occurred. She would be attesting to that. There's still the problem that, according to the BACB, she's not taking the supervision modules, which may make the point moot. But I think our form would answer my questions. Like going back and getting all the supervision forms, I appreciate that. But I'll tell you, I'm going to look at our form that outlines what the supervision looked like, what the time frames were, whether all the activities were appropriate, and whether or not Ms. Gutierrez is going to attest for those that time period and those hours.
So I just have a question for Mr. Harris. Our rules allow for our form or the BACB form. In this particular circumstance, we're determining that the BACB form isn't sufficient. Can we request them to fill out our form, or would it be better to, there's an additional part of the rule that says we can request additional supervision information. So I just want to make sure that having them take the extra step to fill out our form is still okay, even though the rule states we will accept either, but may request additional information.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that's exactly what I think we should do, not comment on requiring the other form be completed, but that she submit additional information. And I think that, Kathy can certainly offer or suggest that information is contained in the other form. If she simply wanted to submit that form, that may be acceptable to the committee as far as answering the questions that it still has.
And essentially, just so that I'm clear, because we are doing an RFI, there will be a letter drafted by board staff, and that's where we could potentially add that information, and then that letter will come to me as the chair, and then we'll send that letter off to the individual.
Yeah, I think in that letter, we just need to be clear what we're asking for, and then to suggest that, in responding, you may want to consider out that other form.
Perfect. Ms. Folks, board staff, is that clear as to what we'd be looking for in the letter, or do you have any questions for us?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think my main question is what documentation would demonstrate that Ms. We know from the BCBA or BACB's online registry document that Ms. Gutierrez did not complete the supervision requirements. Unless that's incorrect, on the online registry, even if she provides supervision logs or our own Arizona form, I'm puzzled as to how that matter can be resolved.
So, Ms. Folks, I'm not sure it can be resolved right away. I think there's a couple of issues. One is she's right at the 1500 hours, but generally in the RFIs, we do notify them that some of their hours may not count. And so she would have the ability, let's say that she has post-certification supervision. So let's say she's still getting supervised. She could provide us additional documentation to support the 1500 hours. She could also provide us documentation that the BACB registry is wrong. And then that would suffice. And then the other piece would be that if she comes back and says, oh, nope, you're right, the BACB has it correct, and she supervised 200 hours, then we would be able to take action on the application. But we can't we don't have the information to even know what action to take. But it's possible that she could have additional hours somewhere that are above and beyond this 1500. It's also possible that they come back and say, actually, no, Alfredo and Emily did all of my supervision and she was going to do some, but ended up not needing to or what have you. So I think there's a lot of avenues that it could go depending on kind of what information she has regarding the circumstance.
Okay, that helps me. Thank you.
And I would also ask that we understand when she began, if she did, when her supervision of the applicant began. Because again, the supervision period is a range where in that range, this individual became licensed. I would like to know if that aligns.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And this is a fairly minor point in comparison, but the addresses on page 4 are not complete.
I think that'll be easy to add in.
You think Tisha has hung up at this point and just decided to withdraw her suggestion to be on the committee?
Nope, she's still there. I see her. I see her name. She is still there. All right. Then what I have is we have applicants 1 through 5 being recommended for full board. We have for Ms. De Marinville, we are submitting an RFI. All right. So do we have a motion to move forward?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye. Okay.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Board staff, if you have any questions, please let us know, and I will look for the email with that letter so that we can get it sent off.
All right. Thank you.
Absolutely. All right. Next agenda item is going to be agenda item number 7. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding applicant interviews to address application disclosures. I just closed that. Ms. Pakanon, will you please provide us an overview of this item?
Yes, Madam Chair. This item is on the agenda at the request of the committee from a previous meeting agenda. The committee has, I think, been somewhat challenged by application disclosures that are not infrequent. And by application disclosures, I mean indications of a previous criminal history or termination from previous employment and so forth. And questions have emerged from those discussions relative to when and under what circumstances and why application interviews might be necessary in order to obtain the clarity that you need to make your recommendation on licensure to the board. And this is a fairly common challenge or struggle that regulatory bodies deal with. And no one is better prepared, I think, than Mark Harris to deliver us with legal advice. And so he's prepared to answer your questions and give you some direction on this agenda item.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Keep in mind, first and foremost, you need to be comfortable with all of the information provided to you in the application before you can make a recommendation. And if you've at any time that it's necessary, one, as we just did in the last case, to get, you know, additional information, clarifying information, or invite the applicant to appear before you, you absolutely have the ability and the responsibility to do so. And, you know, as we saw in the previous case, agenda item six, I mean, also these meetings are so educational. So just having a licensee sometimes appear before you to see that there is a committee, that there is a board, and that licensure is a responsibility and not a privilege. I mean, it's a privilege, but not a right. And that there is a responsibility. I think, you know, sometimes can be, you know, perhaps, you know, the best way to start one's professional career. I think to the extent that you might be able to assist staff in identifying the types of background information disclosures that you do ahead of time so that they may be able to invite the applicant in, that might be beneficial. But it also may be very difficult to articulate, and it really is almost dependent upon a case-by-case analysis and a consensus of the committee members on whether they think continuing the matter so that you can meet with the applicant before making a decision is the path that you want to take.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. I was not at the meeting to discuss or how this discussion came up, and so I'll look to my fellow committee members. But when I think about it, and even to like the RFI request that we just had, I think that there's a large thing that has kind of played an effect this particular year is the COVID, the public health emergency, the different avenues that, you know, we've got getting a temporary license. We've got some, you know, flexibility around the public health emergencies verbiage around not having a license, some of those sorts of things that have kind of made it to where, at least for me, it's a little bit easier to kind of review those and be like, yeah, I'm comfortable with these responses. But I think in the past, and we've had it come up even now, I think we've kind of gotten a little bit away from the RFI process. And I think that this would be a good opportunity to come back and say, look, if we are looking at applicants that we have questions on, or that the information isn't clear, or we have any hesitation or concern, to at that moment request for them to come back. Cause I don't, you know, I don't know that there would be any other way to require or have them come forward ahead of that time. I do think that there's a possibility, and they were on the call, and perhaps we can note it for our stakeholder meeting that we're planning for January. But I think it's a great opportunity for the professional association to maybe educate people on the importance of coming to their application review. So, you know, we have an applicant on the phone today who, had we had a question on the application, like, cool, we would have been able to get it answered and we could have expedited it. But if people choose not to come, then that's kind of one of those consequences of the process. You're not here to answer the questions. We aren't comfortable moving forward. So we need to ask for you to come back before we can process that application, which at least for me has been a little bit funky with all the COVID stuff, just because the need to get professionals going has been high. So there's that. But once the public health emergency is gone, I think we really have to be looking at Are we comfortable with the information being provided? And one thing that stands out for me is that we're very protective of the privacy of the applicant, which I think is great. But I don't want it to mask then our review, because I think, conditions that could affect their ability to practice, or legal issues, are unfortunately for them a part of what we have the right to question and to get more information on and to dig deeper into. And I know it's not, it doesn't always feel good to do that, to colleagues, but our obligation is to protecting the public. And so, those are kind of my thoughts on that, but I'll open it up, to the committee members, as far as the intent of adding this to the application and what thoughts you guys have in light of Mr. Harris's feedback.
Don, this really came in, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. So Matt, Dr. Rates, were you going to say something? It looked like you're about ready to, but
I think I can just comment on, to your point on education. Sometimes I think we have had instances where people come and perhaps part of the worry of presenting to the board or being unclear they could share, should share, need to share, sometimes share a lot and it may be more than they need to. And so I'm wondering if there's a way to, again, from an educational point, perhaps help applicants understand what it is that we're needing to know. And if we are asking someone to come back, maybe having some more clarity around that. I think we've all had instances where we say, is there anything you'd like to share? And they share a lot and seem to be struggling with how much they're sharing. So it is absolutely their right to do all of that. But I wonder if we provide some education or guidance when we're asking people to come to kind of specifically let them know what we're looking for.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, committee members, that was my feeling as well. As I know we've had a few come and discuss convictions that they had as minors, to Dr. Rates's point is whether that information is pertinent. I mean, I think some of it is, but to reiterate what happened that night, given some of the levels of their blood tests for intoxication levels, whether that information is actually very good in the first place. In addition, where they've, they're obviously nervous, scared because they just got pulled over. And then again, what are the constraints or the level of questioning that needs to happen, and the boundaries and maybe as Dr. Reid says, that guidance on here's the information we need to know, this is a public forum and we're having people divulge information. I think it's sometimes, or they're volunteering without an understanding of what they exactly need to be discussing, a lot of information that frankly people don't need to know. And in front of their peers professionally and is now, is being recorded so that people can go back and listen to it again. And so that's a concern of mine. And as Dr. Reid said, is the boundaries or perhaps indicating to them, what should we indicate to them to help them divulge information that is helpful versus a narrative on the night in which it happened, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Dr. Sinop, I think part of it is I sometimes feel, and we actually just got some feedback to the larger board that Heidi shared with us, that in some ways we're asking people to relive traumatic experiences, where they made a poor decision. And, many of the cases we say, this occurred, but, individual got a DWI 5 years ago. Hey, have you been, Have you been in any further trouble since then? No, you know, I use Uber, a designated drivers, COVID won't let me go out and party, whatever the answer may be, right? And we say, all right, it sounds like you've been on the straight and narrow for quite some time. Let's move forward. And so to me, some of the thought process I have is, you know, based on what's disclosed to us, a DWI, a minor in possession, if that, you know, some statute of limitations on ourselves of like, do we really need the nitty gritty detail to an individual who got, you know, who was pulled over for a DWI 5 years ago and has no other issues going on since then? And I think, you know, it's just, I understand our need to protect public safety, but also in reading that feedback that I think only Dr. Davis Wilson and I have seen from Heidi, you know, those are traumatic experiences and they have put that behind them and moved forward. We've also had cases where they have not put it behind them and they continue to have what we would refer to as questionable or criminal activity. And those are important for us to ask those questions and to really get into. But I do kind of have this, I think I shared the concern, the reason we put this on there is like, where do we draw the line? And, you know, how far back do we need to go to something that is what I'll refer to as a minor offense? We also have the very real issue that now we have decriminalization of marijuana in the state of Arizona. And so we're gonna see convictions for, as we've seen in the front of this board prior, as well as the larger board, where that's no longer going to be something that, you know, had that happened today, would not rise to that level. And so I think we're just looking at particular guidance about, you know, and I don't know how if the psychologist screening committee, you know, has some brackets around, you know, things that happened 5 years ago forward, those are fair game for us to pick apart. But something that happened 7 years ago, 10 years ago, and there's no other indication of continued activity in that area, are we sufficient with just the written response and not having to relive that?
And Dr. David, to your point too, I think the, you know, use statute of limitations or what we're allowed to discuss. And I think there are some things that we should discuss. You know, if we have a, let's just say a 35-year-old person before us or submitting an application, and maybe this negates their application to begin with in the first place, but there was statutory rape or something along those lines, you know, that automatically may negate their application anyway. But that's something to discuss. Whereas perhaps a DUI for alcohol and you know, now as it is marijuana is you know, there's probably some variation on what I guess would be fair game or not.
Misdemeanors versus felonies, kind of thing.
Dr. Davey, I do want to chime in, and I want to let Heidi's been trying to speak as well, but I think.
Sorry.
That's okay. I think the bigger part before I hand it over to her is two things. One, our role as a board is not to, in my opinion, is not to protect the applicants and their privacy. I think that the role of having the committee and the board is to allow democratic process to take place, which means that there are going to be individuals, whether it's a public member at the full board or that might feel uncomfortable about something. For me in particular, oftentimes, like because I'm one that will ask about like BAC levels and such, two things that come to mind for me. One, those questions, that's all public information that's going to be posted with their applicant anyway. But for me, it's usually the inconsistency between their response of, well, it was just a minor thing. And then you read the police report and it wasn't minor. And then that, to me, triggers a potential larger issue of not recognizing the significance of what happened or trying to dismiss the significance of what happened. And if they're dismissing it without further question, I do raise concern about their current actions and whether or not they are able to discriminate what is a public health concern and what's not. I also want to add, though, that as far as them sharing too much information, I think that this goes back to the professional association maybe educating on their rights to have an attorney present. We aren't attorneys, and so I don't think that we can guide them on what to share or not share. I think that ideally, if they have a concern, they should be consulting with an attorney, and that attorney should be communicating with our attorney and or having, you know, these meetings. But I hesitate as to kind of what our role as committee members are, and further the board members. I hesitate to say that there would be any type of prescribed guidance, because there's a lot of circumstantial pieces that may need to be explored. And I'll tell you that on the application review committees or the complaint screening committees for the psychologist, there's oftentimes a public member. So those are the questions that they're most interested in, because they don't know the clinical side of things. They're looking at more of those character pieces that kind of red flag as well, because they don't know, was an assessment used right, or did they have the correct university, or they don't know those pieces. So I think it comes down to really reminding ourselves or having conversation around what our role is. But Ms. Pacanon, would you like to comment? I apologize for bogarting that.
No, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to address this. I'm listening to this, and I'm trying to think of, you know, possible ways that board staff can help in this process. And I'll describe what our approach has been to date. Kathy in particular, and, you know, when I see the application as well, we have definitely identified instances where we felt like, okay, this is such a minimal cursory explanation of the disclosure. This is absolutely going to trigger an invitation for an application interview. And we, of course, have seen instances, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, where, you know, there's some discrepancy in the facts and so forth. So again, our thinking is, okay, this applicant is coming before the committee. I'm wondering if it's appropriate for board staff to try to, I don't want to do too much in the form of coaching, but try to, you know, provide some, at least some guidance to applicants that if your explanation is less than thorough, you can expect an invitation to be interviewed before the committee, you know, something to that effect. So if we can, I mean, there's been instances where the explanation is so thorough and compelling that, you know, it was merely acknowledged by you and then forwarded on. So if there is a way that we can sort of, you know, provide that guidance to minimize the instances where they have to come before the committee to clarify something that they said or they didn't say or they misspoke about. So that's what I'm thinking.
Madam Chair, committee members, this is Kathy. My other question, Heidi covered one of mine, but one of my other questions is to use an example, one of our psychologist applicants in recent years had 5 incidences of shoplifting and substance abuse that she reported on her application. I obtained all the criminal records, or the police records and court records. She was eventually approved for licensure, and recently she has had, I believe she signed a consent agreement because she now has, it's been discovered she has a substance abuse problem. And if we had not had the history in the application and her attestation that she was now clean and sober, I don't know if that would have affected how the board was able to act this year with the report of substance abuse. Heidi, do you know what I'm talking about? I just wonder if, I mean, I understand about someone, you know, who's a minor and hasn't had any other problems, or needing to go back more than 10 years when there's no other incident in the last 10 years. But in this case, with this particular applicant, if I remember correctly, the original issues that she had were in the early 2000s up through, I believe it was 2008. And she applied since I've been here. So it's only been in the last couple of years. So that was a 10-year, going back 10 to 15 years on her history. And it turned out she's still having problems and is not permitted to practice at this time. So that's just one of my thoughts.
Ms. Spoke.
Chair. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm familiar with that particular situation, and I think it brings to light some additional situations that we've seen, of which a previous indication of substance abuse may also be an indication of underlying medical issues that prevents them from being able to practice competently. And this is where I think as behavior analysts, it's a little bit challenging for us, because it wouldn't necessarily be within our scope of practice to gauge their current mental health status. But I'll tell you, on the pool board side, that is something that would happen, is that they would go in the confidential, and perhaps that's what we refer them to, is for the full board, for full board action, and we take no action, because they will take it into the confidential executive session, because it's usually at that point involving some level of PHI for the applicant. So it does go into executive session, and they will ask specific questions to gauge whether or not that substance abuse and or that mental health condition is currently a concern. And so that might be something else to consider, because I'm aware Ms. Folks is correct. It was about a 10-year period that the individual had gone to grad school, got her doctorate, went and did her hours, did everything. And so they were, and they talked with her, and they felt confident moving forward. And then this happened. But I think we've even seen it in other cases of really needing to just go into that executive session and ask further questions to gauge that factor. But I think that as behavior analysts, there might be limitations in our ability to do that, where the full board with the psychologist may have a better means of doing that. Just a thought. Dr. Sinha.
Yeah, and that, Madam Chair, committee members, that point is well taken. The suggestion, or the guidance request, was more not necessarily for their application. Obviously, the psychologist to whom you all are speaking is it's evident that documentation is there. Likewise, if we have people applying to become licensed behavior analysts, that documentation will be in there, as is their minor records will also be in there. The guidance, what I was seeking mainly, the concern I had was the amount of information. And, you know, I know sometimes they talk more than they need to, or divulge more than they need to, was just that constraint of that information. Or perhaps, as Madam Chair suggested, we move into executive session with that individual and have that discussion, so that they're not unnecessarily bearing their souls to the board or to the committee and to other colleagues, to be recorded and forever being able to access by people. And I understand the records are there, but I think some of the further information is discussed. I would be hesitant to share that openly with other people, with potential colleagues, potential clients, and so on. So.
Well, and Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could just, you know, follow up on Dr. Steinhoff's comments, I think it is important to be sensitive to the applicant. And anytime, whether you're a licensee or an applicant and you're asked to come before a committee or the board, that creates emotions, and that can be, very stressful. I do think that you have a number of tools available to you, and I think you've already identified them. One, Madam Chair, as you suggested, you do have the ability to go into executive session, and absolutely any part of their background that is protected by law, we will do everything that we can to preserve that protection, that confidentiality. As discussed, some information, though, while it may be very uncomfortable to talk about, there are no privileges associated with it. It is public. And to the extent that we have applicants that may be providing a little bit too much information, I do think that, we do have the ability to kind of refocus or redirect them into the type of information that you're soliciting. as opposed to just letting them kind of go on and on, not really being sure, you know, if the, you know, what they should say. And then maybe there's a tendency to say too much, and quite frankly, things that you don't necessarily find, you know, relevant to your review of the application and their qualifications to, you know, safely and competently practice. So there are already tools available to you. I also just have a question, and I'm just curious, at the board, do they have a set of criteria in which they follow when determining whether to invite an applicant in to address them, or do they do it on a case-by-case basis after reviewing everything that board staff has submitted? And I very much appreciated Heidi's comments, because, you know, I think, you know, Heidi mentioned, you know, kind of coaching, you know, certainly Kathy and Heidi have seen enough applications to know, you know, what the board members are thinking, what the committee members, you know, think, and to the extent that they can kind of assist, you know, the applicant in the process, I always think that that's, you know, really helpful to, and just generally just good chamber of commerce. Again, oftentimes this is their first interaction with the board. So to the extent that it can be, you know, a positive experience, I just think, you know, starts off that relationship in the right direction. But I am, you know, curious to know if there's anything that we can emulate from the board or take from the board that they use that we may, we might not be utilizing right now.
Ms. Paknon or Ms. Michelson, are you guys aware of any criteria or any process that, any systematic process that the ARC committee uses to determine whether or not to invite an applicant for discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any sort of hard and fast rules that ARC applies when they are reviewing applications. I mean, I've heard them sort of say, you know, if the criminal charge, criminal history is dated, you know, same sort of conversation here. If it's, you know, relatively, you know, minor infraction, you know, certainly not a, you know, felony conviction or one involving moral turpitude, you know, it's something that sort of, you know, can be cursory acknowledgement on the record, and then they move on. I think that my observation is this committee reviews many more of these types of disclosures than ARC does. So I'm not sure, you would think that ARC would be, you know, maybe a barometer for you, but I'm not sure that they are, just by sheer numbers. You see more of these instances than they do.
Thank you. I would concur with that.
That's interesting. I wonder if there's something in the process of their post-grad and pre-grad internships, or their pre-doc and post-doc internships, if there's specific background checks or something that might field potential applicants in this area before they even complete a program and move forward. Because that's the only thing, I mean, it's very rare that we're seeing anything that stands out so largely that it's like, and like I said, for the most part, the parts that make me uncomfortable is just the inconsistency of the report that makes it sound kind of dismissive of like, oh, you know, I kind of went out with a friend and then this happened. And next thing you know, you find out, no, they were stopped in a travel lane with high BAC. And again, like some of those, like, I don't know that these two things match. And that, again, to me does raise a red flag of whether or not they are safe to practice without further questioning. But I, other than that discrepancy, and I think it's we've determined that when we do question them, there hasn't been further concern. Other than that, just discrepancy there, it's not like we're seeing like huge, crazy things. But I think it's interesting that we're seeing more in this committee than we are at the ARC committee.
Madam Chair, this is Kathy. In relation to your question, I've been doing licensing for almost 14 years now. January will be my 14th anniversary. The as the licensing admin person, I request, I always have to request the police records and the court records. And if they, and if the record's been expunged or in, you know, some law enforcement agencies or courts purge their records, they have a statute of, you know, where they retention schedule, they get rid of them. And so I always have to have a, because I can't always trust the applicant to know what they're talking about. I've had many applicants who tell me, oh, their records don't exist, it was expunged, blah, 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 and come to find out the records are definitely there. And so I have them give me a letter from law enforcement or court telling me that the records don't exist and why, so that you guys have at least something to show for why there aren't any records. The other thing is, I don't ask applicants to come to the committee meeting on a general basis, like you were talking about earlier. I actually don't even tell them that they can come unless there's a yes answer that's been a matter really in the last 5 years. If it's been in the last 5 years, that's when I'll say, you might want to come, here's the information, because the committee might have questions. But that's generally has been my process. If you want all applicants to be notified and invited, I'd be happy to do that as well. I can.
Ms. Folks, I think that's good information for us to have. I also think that this goes, you know, back to potential conversation with stakeholders of patterns that we're seeing and how they could potentially, from an education standpoint, because again, I try to think of what our role is as a board versus like what the professional association's role is as far as educating and assisting with some of those things. I wonder if they, you know, would be interested in hearing that these are some of the patterns and concerns. And I agree. I think that the concern of them divulging too much information or things going on public record, it is concerning because they don't know. But at the same time, I go back to like kind of, again, our role, and I don't know that it's our role to necessarily mitigate that, but to maybe continue to communicate to the association. This is a pattern that we're seeing. And while I definitely think that we can do things, especially with Zoom, that we couldn't do over the phone, it like, you know, stopping individuals and saying, wait, hold on, that's not the question we're asking. That's much harder to do over the phone. But I think via Zoom, especially when we're face to face with people, we could definitely, you know, I would be happy as a chair to continue to kind of delineate those things with some of your guys' help. Because for me, there are a lot of things that that I think are just kind of the nature of going through the regulatory process. I talk to my ethics students about it. And I make them come and listen to these calls because they need to know that their actions may come back and they may have to answer to them or have these conversations. So I would welcome you guys also chiming in and being like, hey, Madam Chair, I think this needs to go into executive session or something, and feeling empowered to do that just in case I do have a difference of opinion of kind of what I'm allowing to go. I think that would be an easy fix, but I definitely think it would be nice to see, I don't know if it's something the professional association can work with Ms. Packnon on, or if they want to, you know, reach out nationally to try to figure out some experts or to get an attorney to present CEUs to their members about what information to share and what not to share. Because I just really hesitate because keep in mind that anything that we kind of guide in those places could become something that we have to remember how we handled it in the past when another case comes up, so that we're not changing how we're handling cases. And that's where I think for me, some of it becomes more of a legal issue. And I personally would encourage people again to utilize their legal representation where necessary, because I think an attorney can navigate that more consistently and aligned with the statutes than what we can.
So Madam Chair, the only thing I would just bring back is I think, and it really is sticking, you know, hitting close to home, having read the documents that Ms. Packanon said. It's just, you know, I think is balancing our need to know, to protect the public, and and crossing that line of like where we ask a question that just is going to, we know is going to go down that path that's probably more than what we need to know. Like it's got, I mean, part of that is we're the lead on it. And so I think, just trying to figure out some ways that when we ask the questions that we kind of put them in brackets of like, this is what we need to know, kind of just the facts, ma'am, kind of thing. Because it is hard. Like leaving some of those board calls and even some of these discussions, like I feel like sometimes like, wow, that had to be a very hard conversation, particularly the ones that were at the board level recently. Like I wouldn't want, my family members, myself, my daughters to have to have those kinds of conversations in public hearings. And so I just want us, I think what came from the conversation was, I think it's important upon all of us to respect the dignity of the applicant and balance that with the need to be able to protect the public. And, just keeping, for Mr. Harris, keeping the balance there, the balance of those two, at all times. Like we don't want to provide the out to not get the information to protect the public and open up ourselves to scrutiny that way. But at the same time, I think we need to offer some respect to the individual who's having to go through something that most likely was traumatic. So I think that's really the conversation. We can ask the professional board to work on those things, but I think it's incumbent upon us as someone who's going to hear that to understand when we should go to executive session and put that, put those protections in place, when we can ask our questions, that are really a yes, no, or a, versus a, give us a, kind of like today, discuss this. That I think leads to a lot of information that's probably not really getting to the point. Like your question of like, well, listen, you wrote, 0.5 on your statement here for a blood alcohol content, but the police report says, 0.15, what's the discrepancy there? That's probably a question where they could talk about that. So I think, I don't want to continue to ramble on, but I think it's just something we need to be aware of as committee members when those come to us, that we should work on that balance.
Dr. Davia, I agree with that. I do also just want for context purposes to clarify the feedback that we received was a complainant, not an applicant. And I think that is important context because it was a complainant that felt as though they were kind of having to expose, and share this information when they were just trying to have a matter resolved. And so I think that role does make a difference for me, not necessarily dismissing anything that you're saying, because I agree with that too, but just for context purposes, I think I wouldn't relate that feedback to this particular issue just because it was the complainant. And while yes, the events may be traumatic, we've seen circumstances with why the period of substance abuse was related to a specific very, very traumatic event. So I agree. I think all of those points are well taken. But I think, yeah, balancing those two and knowing that we're just one part of the equation. So we can definitely try to mitigate those things, continue to push for executive session. I would hesitate in getting to a position where we feel like, again, in fear of just protecting their dignity, we don't ask questions. And then that puts us in a position of then, falling on our obligation to protect the public. But keeping in mind that everything that we review at this committee then goes to the full board. And we don't have the ability at that point, if they have further questions or they want to speak to the individual, we don't have the ability to kind of put those mechanisms in place for the full board, because these are all common questions that the full board asks in public meetings all the time. And so I just want to be cognizant of that too, of if we're not being careful, I don't want to be in a position where we're not asking questions and it goes to the full board and the full board says, wait, why were you not asking questions? And we're saying it's not pertinent and they feel it is pertinent, because I think that could present a problem as well. And so I like the idea of maybe talking more about how we can get it into executive session so that's kind of a happy medium of we're still able to ask those questions, but we're able to do it in a way that does protect some of, you know, the dignity and the feelings of the applicant. But as a reminder, you know, confident or the executive sessions are for legal advice or for health information. And so some of these criminal charges wouldn't qualify for going to executive session because they might not be related to their own personal health information. And so again, I just want to be cognizant that that if we can stretch around it or have the conversation or ask in that moment the attorney, hey, would we be able to go into executive session? If we, I think we could definitely do those things, but I just want to be cognizant that if we're not careful and it goes to the full board, and the full board has red flags raised, I don't want them coming back and feeling, any potential distrust, or, lack of confidence in the committee's work.
I think we're all saying the same thing. I mean, I think one, substance abuse is a health condition that could be discussed. Whether that's alcohol or drugs. So I don't have an issue with us having those discussions inside of executive committee and feels that that would be pertinent. I also think that the full board does pay a lot of deference to this committee. And when applications are moved forward, there's very little question of whether or not those are going to pass. And so obviously we don't want to bridge or break that trust. That being said, I think you've had the same experience, Madam Chair, is when there are questions that go beyond what the ARC is willing to deal with, then that is taken off the consent agenda and put forward, and typically ends up in a formal interview and those kinds of things to get more information. And that's probably a mechanism we need to use more often, you know, as kind of maybe provide the board the opportunity to ask those questions in the appropriate fashion through an interview, or for us to do that prior to going forward. So I think we're saying the same thing. Like, yes, we've got to balance it. Whether it's the applicant or someone who's coming forward with a complaint, like everybody, they're all human beings. And I just think like we need to treat everybody with, you know, with that dignity while we're protecting the public. So I agree with everything we're saying. And I think it's just, you know, it's a good discussion to have and probably something we're not going to solve. I think it's just more of a heads up to all of us.
Mr. Harris, I do have one question around kind of, and I don't know that it would matter. I just wonder if there was a way that we could feel confident in saying something like, if it happened 10 years ago, we don't need to ask questions to it, or if it's just contextual and based on whatever information we have present to us in that moment.
Yeah, I do think, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you want to, you know, look into setting, you know, some sort of, you know, criteria in that, you know, offensive, you know, or background information that's more than 5 years old related to this, we don't necessarily need to see, or, you know, 10 years or 15 years. One of the things, though, that I would suggest if you're going to go down that path is to do that in the form of making recommendations to the board so that they're aware of what, you know, criteria you're utilizing when reviewing applications. They may have some suggestions or some input into that. But I don't think there's anything that would prohibit you from, you know, in essence, coming up with some sort of matrix.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, could I ask a question?
Yes, Ms. Folk.
Well, two things. Mr. Harris, in listening to this discussion, it makes me wonder, my understanding has been that police reports or police records and court records are public. Is that correct? Now, if the BAC is in, you know, the lab reports are in the police record or the court record, are those also public because they're part of the charge and arrest, et cetera, or should they be classified as confidential?
No, the BAC is public record.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. And then my other thought was that hopefully, if all goes well with the legislature, that by this summer, or by the end of the summer, we'll have the fingerprint card as a requirement. And so every applicant will be going through background checks prior to applying for licensure. So I think that that may possibly give you more confidence in setting a limit on how many on how many years you want to go back on some of these yes answers on professional conduct questions.
That's a good point. Any other comments or thoughts? I know, Mr. Harris, I appreciate you. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Mr. Harris.
I was just going to say my little battery on my laptop is going to turn red here in a moment. If for some reason you lose me visually, I will then call in and participate telephonically for the rest of the committee meeting. And I apologize. I didn't bring in an extension cord or a power cord, I'm sorry, with me this morning. So
that's okay. I think we're close to wrapping up. I think that this is a good discussion to continue and possibly follow. I forgot about the fingerprint clearance cards, and because most of our employment requirements, especially with working with minors, is a level one, I do think that that'll clear a lot of this up, because if they're able to obtain it, then that might be a mechanism of the matrix of the metric that we use that says, well, they were able to obtain this fingerprint card, so we would still ask the question, because it's a statutory question that we ask. It's still public record in their application, but I think that would give us a uniform, like, hey, we don't have to ask further questions specific to this because of their ability to already obtain that level one fingerprint clearance card. It'll be interesting for that, though. I'm hoping that with legislation, they'll figure out a way for DPS to communicate with the regulatory boards, because I can tell you in practice, we're running into issues where if you're not actually going to the DPS website and checking the cards, they're not notifying current employers. Because if you got it done at a previous employer and they just brought the card for a copy and you just made a copy, and 4 months later it gets revoked, if you don't manually go in and check that as an employer, you aren't necessarily always notified. And so it'll be interesting to see what legislation does as far as communicating to the regulatory board, hey, this person's fingerprint clearance card is suspended or what have you. But as an employer, it's kind of a nightmare right now, because we're having to frequently go in and run everybody's fingerprint clearance card to ensure that they haven't been revoked. Unless it's somebody that as an employer you've hired and you've put through the process, your information goes on the application. And so DPS does notify you. But if you're accepting a card from, you know, somewhere else, you have to go to DPS's website and input that information, and you don't get notified if it changes. So that'll be interesting, but I think it's a good metric. And then, like I said, I welcome the committee's kind of feedback in kind of stopping applicants or stopping and suggesting we go or asking if we can go into executive session if I'm not catching on to something that might be divulging too much information. I think that is a good kind of start in the right direction. And then if there's any committee members that want to take a stab at maybe some metrics to propose to the full board, I agree it probably should go to the full board so that they're aware, and that might help alleviate some of those concerns of the consent agenda items being pulled off, because then we can go back and say, remember, we talked to you guys and said this was something we were going to do. I think that would be helpful. So if there's anybody who wants to take a stab at that, fine, or we can wait and see what happens with this fingerprint clearance thing and see if perhaps that helps address some of our concerns.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Folks.
Again, this is Kathy with the background check. I mean, the fingerprint card. I had, when this first was brought forward for a requirement, I looked it up, and I have been planning that I'm going to have to go to the DPS website and download the current status of the fingerprint card for every single applicant. So you will see those in the applications once this is a requirement.
Perfect. Awesome. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Harris. It was helpful. I would just like to suggest that we potentially also have a conversation with the stakeholders about this to see if again, being that it's a pattern, to see if they want to do some educating around it to their members. All right. Hearing no further discussion, we will now move to agenda item number 8, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recent updates from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. Ms. Pacanon, can you please provide us an update?
Yes, Madam Chair, just a couple of updates. The BCBA has supplied us with a little bit of information specific to the ethics department, the disciplinary team, as they are called. I think they're just sort of trying to, pull the curtain away a little bit from some of, how they process their investigations. Most of this information, I think, is mostly germane to Ms. Michelson, as she would be, communicating directly with them to obtain information on, information that concerns our licensees, information that we need to be shared and so forth. But I provided it to you just for, your information purposes. And then the second update, organization has compiled the standards into handbooks. So they supplied links to both the current editions for BCBA and BCABA, both current and then also the versions that will be migrating to effective January of 2022. I don't think this committee is going to be actually, using these handbooks in any application for what you need to do, but it's, I think, a great resource or great resources to be aware of.
Thank you. Ms. Pacanon, I would request that perhaps we include those handbooks when we get into the topics of the rule writing that we are looking to do going into next year. That might be nice to have readily available for us as we tackle some of the rule writing.
Certainly.
Any other questions from committee members? Hearing none, we will move to agenda item number 9, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding licensure and regulatory issues related to COVID-19. Ms. Pacanon, will you please provide us an update?
The only update that I have is I was in a meeting semi-recently in the past week and a half, I believe, where some of the governor's policy advisors were present. It was a statewide human resources focused conversation. And the governor is still urging employees, if they are successful working remotely, to continue doing so remotely. And what occurred to me is not only should we consider that in the context of the board staff, the staff that you employ to execute your work, but by extension, the committee members, the board members, you too are state employees. So it may be that, we should apply the governor's advisory to continue to apply it as we have, which is remote meetings. So I don't see anything changing in the relatively near future. I know the governor had an update yesterday that I'll confess I have yet to listen to. And I don't know that anything was addressed that's specific to what we do. But if when I go back and listen to it, if there's something important, I will relay it to the committee and to the board.
Thank you, Ms. Pacanon. I did listen to it, and I don't see anything that would be pertinent to us or any changes at this time to where we are currently as a state. All right. The hearing no other comments or questions, we will move to agenda item number 10, and that's going to be new agenda items for future meetings. I have noted that I would like in the stakeholders conversation to discuss the education component of the applications and, perhaps being present for applications so that we can ask questions, and then perhaps some education around how to properly answer the questions without divulging information that's not necessary. And see if that's something that they might be interested in relaying to their members. And then I also believe there was something else, requesting that the professional association consider some conversations with their members around board complaints and the role of supervisors and that sort of stuff. So those would just be kind of just suggestions for them based on patterns that we're seeing. I know that there were two board members that were on the call earlier today. It looks like they had jumped off, ASIABA board members that were on the call. Other thoughts on items for future agendas?
Madam Chair, I just want to jump in and mention that it looks like January 22nd, which is a Friday, that seems to be the date and time that works for everyone thus far. So January 22nd from 8:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. was what I had blocked. So all other times, we have at least one committee member that can't make it. So why don't we pencil that in? And hopefully Ms. Denton will be able to join us. And I'll reach out right away to the leadership of the two associations.
Perfect.
Would you be so kind to just send us a placeholder for our calendars?
Yes, I certainly will.
Madam Chair, committee members, I just wondered, was it the conclusion of the committee that you would like me to invite all applicants to attend the committee meeting where their application is being reviewed?
Ms. Packman.
I know that we can find language from other boards where their notices say something to the effect of, you know, your participation, attendance and participation is highly encouraged but not required. If that's the right balance to strike, we can do something like that.
Ms. Pecknon, I appreciate that, and I would be in agreement with moving forward with that. I think that I've heard it multiple ways, and I think we've had, you know, some people attend and be like, oh, this is great, I'm glad I've attended, and then I've had my own students say like, oh, I didn't even know I was allowed to attend. So I like the idea of educating them that they're encouraged to attend. I think most of the feedback that we get when someone does attend is that they stay for the full meeting and they are appreciative of the learning opportunity. So I like the idea of having some language in there just to kind of encourage people to become familiar with this process a little bit more.
All right, I'll work with Heidi on that. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Hearing no other potential meeting items. Oh, actually, sorry. Couldn't get off that easy. I do have one. I believe, Ms. Packanon, you sent an email specific to officer positions for 2021. We still have the potential need to do a chair for this committee for 2021. Is that something we want to just tackle at the next meeting?
Yes, Madam Chair. So Ms. Michelson and I were discussing this just the other day, and what we were going to recommend was that we sort of see how the officer elections play out for the board, and then that may have implications for how you may want to approach the officer elections or assignments for this committee.
Okay. That if everybody's in agreement with that, then I'll remain chair for the January meeting, and then we'll have it on the agenda, because we should know by the January meeting, because the officer elections are this next December meeting, correct?
Correct. And this committee, I could not find that there's any language in your statutes or rules that indicate or require a certain time frame for officers to serve or officers to be elected. There are timeframes associated with the board. So I think let the board's timeframes, you know, sort of dictate what we do here at the committee level.
Perfect. That sounds great. All right. Then we'll move to agenda item number 11, and that is adjournment. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved, Madam Chair.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any further discussion? Sweet. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Oh, here's the baby. I know she's going to join us late, but.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Look at her.
I wanted to hold her and smell her.
Oh, how cute. Yes.
She's sweet. She dresses up for every occasion, by the way. I have bows for every outfit she owns. It's a problem.
What a fashionista already.
Yeah. Yeah, she put them off well.
Yeah.
She's a good baby.
Matching bows. You need to have a matching one with you, Tinsley, and the little one.
Tinsley does. For every bow that she has, Tinsley has a matching one. So Tinsley has, like, because I buy them in sets. One is a baby headband and one is as an actual, like, alligator clip bow. So the two of them do match. Tinsley actually likes her. So we're winning because I was really concerned that Tinsley was not even going to like her. So now they have matching bows and I'm not really a bow person, but if I was, I'm sure I could also match.
How cute.
All right. Bye, guys.
Have a good day, everyone. Thank you. Bye. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.